members. Okay, so I'm going on. Thank you, Minister. Now, our next strategic objective is to contribute to the health and well-being of our learners and to reduce barriers to learning through screening and then identifying any problems such as hearing problems, sight problems. There we've achieved and exceeded our targets. And also just to highlight that we make referrals where we pick up problems, kids who need glasses or help to get glasses, and it's quite an achievement. In terms of protecting girl learners against cervical cancer, we've achieved our target for the first dose. For the second dose, we've fell short of our target, but again, this relates to the fact that a new mobile technology was introduced in order to capture and record data. And in that transition, again, there's been some reporting errors. So we really believe more children have been vaccinated. In fact, that 63.8%, when we tried to reconcile data, triangulating different data sources, it came to 69%, still short of the target, but indicating that it's more a reporting error. We've also developed our cervical cancer control policy and our breast cancer policy, and these have both served at our tech NHC, but they've been sent back for costing and further work to be done, looking at the costs. In the last meeting, we looked at the issues relating to the cost, especially of the drug for breast, the most common type of breast cancer, so I'm not going to go into that again unless members have questions later. In terms of our adolescent and youth guidelines and all our targets here, we've done well. We've met all our targets. So I'll just proceed to the next slide, which deals with a bit of a challenge which we can look at, and that is the problem of MDR-TB in the country. We will see that while we've achieved our initiation of TB HIV co-infected patients on ART, and we've achieved our HIV testing coverage rates, we've been having a challenge with the numbers of circumcisions that we should have achieved in terms of our target, but based on past performance, the program has decided now to revise the target downwards. It was maybe just an unrealistic target that we were setting. Other than that, we've achieved all our other targets. So I'll move on. On this slide here, we're looking again at a number of indicators related to HIV. And here, too, we've achieved our targets. Largely achieved our targets. And we're working hard with districts to really keep patients in treatment, improve the monitoring of HIV patients and support adherence to treatment. In terms of the last indicator there, which is to facilitate the development of district plans to support male and female condom distribution, we work with provinces, and we've had 44 district plans developed against our child target of 52. But that was by the end of the year, and that was the audited figure. Later, we managed to have all our district plans in place. Now, in terms of TB screening, Our target for the indicator of 5 years and older screened at health facilities for TB symptoms, we've achieved 36.1 against our target of 50. TB clients 5 years and older initiated on treatment, we've achieved that target. In terms of rifampicin-resistant clients' treatment initiation rate, we've also fallen short of our target, largely due to the fact that some provinces have not really performed very well, therefore bringing the overall target down, and these provinces are really Eastern Cape and Gauteng. In terms of the TB new client treatment success rate, you can see we're achieving our success rate for clients in, on TB treatment. The problem relates really to TB MDR, MDR TB. You will see there that our loss to follow-up remains high, our client death rate remains high, higher than our planned target. But there's now a more effective drug regimen for MDR TB, a drug called bedaquiline, and we believe that this will help to address the problem of the death rate and for MDR TB, and also help to keep. We're also putting in place strategies, community-based mobilization strategies to trace defaulters, but also to educate the community about MDR TB and to ensure that we track MDR patients better and that we reduce loss to follow up in that way. In terms of the percentage of mines providing routine TB screening, we've done very well on all the other indicators. In terms of our performance improvement strategies, I've really highlighted most of them as I've gone along. So I won't repeat myself here. We can then move to program four, which is primary healthcare services. With regards to program four, there's been some key achievements which I'd like to highlight. The Ideal Clinic Initiative was started in July 2013, and as at the end of March 2016, we had a cumulative total of 322 facilities qualifying as Ideal. We also have our municipal ward-based outreach teams who are hard at work, and the program has been expanded during the 2015-16 financial year, so that by the end of March, we actually had 2,590 functional ward-based primary healthcare outreach teams, which is an increase of 842 teams from a baseline of 1748, where we started in the previous financial year. We also had Port Health services successfully transferred from the provincial departments of health to the National Department of Health, and we've implemented a hand hygiene, a behavior change strategy for hand hygiene. As DG always points out, hand washing is one of the most effective prevention interventions in terms of preventing infection. And in the 2015-16 financial year, attention was also paid to promoting healthy eating in the workplace and in early development centres. We also put in place regulations relating to healthcare waste management, and the regulations cover various aspects of healthcare waste that are applicable to both private and public establishments, but exclude radioactive, electronic and animal waste. And notably, South Africa was presented with the African Leaders Malaria Alliance Award for achieving the Malaria Millennium Development Goal at the ALMA meeting for heads of state and government of the African Union, which I think is really a great achievement, and we've met our target for having a 24-hour reporting system in place for malaria, and that this should be fully functional in 5 districts. Another key achievement was the drafting of the district health management office structure and job profiles with a view to strengthening governance and management and leadership of the district health system. In terms of the primary healthcare facilities with functional clinic committees, we also have exceeded our target, as well as the target on ward-based outreach teams, as I've highlighted earlier. can move on to the next slide. I think here I've also highlighted that we have basically achieved our targets. So we can move on to the next slide, looking at reducing risk factors and improving management for non-communicable diseases. Now, as we all know, non-communicable diseases are becoming a big problem. So we're very happy to highlight to honorable members that we've achieved our targets against this strategic objective. And in particular, with people screened for high blood pressure, for blood glucose, we've exceeded our targets and done very well. In terms of monitoring salt content in foodstuffs, salt is a big problem. There we just fell short of achieving our target in that we purchased chemicals so that we can do our lab tests on salt, but unfortunately there was a problem with shipping, and this caused us not the shipping of the chemicals led to us not leading our target there. In terms of having content finalized for a campaign related to a healthy lifestyle, specifically the key risk factors of alcohol intake, excessive salt, excessive sugar, and physical inactivity, we've developed the content and we've implemented our campaign. If we go to our next slide, we will see there that it deals again with another key problem, which is mental health services in South Africa. Now, we have set ourselves four targets against four indicators, and I'm really proud to report that we've actually achieved all our targets here. Just sadly, we had the newspaper coverage about our mental health patients that were discharged from hospital, but in terms of our APP, we've met our targets, honorable members. So we can move then to the next slide, which looks at disability services. With disability services, we had a target that we should have allocated resources for our framework, because we have a disability framework for rehab services. We have a framework for the implementation of rehab services in the country. But a change of approach was necessitated, and it was felt that we needed to look more at the readiness of provinces to implement this framework and model, and whether the resources are really in place to do so. That's what really necessitated the change in approach and why we did the readiness study. And that is now still underway, and the main aim was really to prevent implementing a program for which there is not adequate budget and falling short, therefore, of our target. In terms of avoidable blindness, we have fallen short on our cataract surgery rate. But as I pointed out, we're doing well on malaria, so I won't go into details there, and we've achieved all the other targets on the slide related to communicable diseases. So on the next slide, it's still related to communicable diseases. We really did very well in terms of influenza prevention and control, whereby we set ourselves a target of immunizing 800,000 high-risk individuals with the influenza vaccine, and we exceeded that target. We have also put in place a strategy for the integration of disease surveillance systems for notifiable medical conditions, We put in place a surveillance system for notifiable medical conditions, and we have implemented our antenatal seroprevalence survey in 2014, and the report is now just being finalized and will be launched by Minister very shortly. In terms of performance improvement strategies, it really relates to the disabilities area where, as I indicated, we decided to first do a readiness of districts assessment, and this was required to avoid expenditure not planned for really and which could result in disorganized service delivery. We also put in place a strategy to improve cataract surgery because this was the other area we fell short on, and the costing strategy is now being done. And then the testing of salt content in foods, which we didn't do, these were really the only areas we fell short in this program. This will now be done in this financial year. That brings us now to our fifth and second last program, which is hospitals, tertiary services and workforce development. In this program, we've had 1,000 facilities benchmarked against the primary healthcare staffing normative guides. We've had coaching and mentoring and training programs, coaching, mentoring and training program implemented for health managers, which has been developed and being implemented now. We've also made good progress in various health facilities with regards to infrastructure projects. We've managed to achieve our targets, really, even exceed our targets with regards to facilities maintained, repaired and or refurbished. We've also achieved our targets with regards to clinics and community health care centres constructed and revitalised, and doctors' consulting rooms constructed and completed. We had also achieved 78 against a target of 37. In terms of food tests, 16,140 food tests were performed against a target of 4,000. So we actually achieved our target fourfold. If we go to the actual table, it's just explaining what I've explained now. And in terms of that, we had some challenges with regards to the second indicator, number of gazetted tertiary hospitals providing the full package of tertiary services. Here, we've had a target of 4 additional tertiary hospitals providing the full package of tertiary services, but we actually managed to achieve none there, largely because the subspecialties are not available, and these hospitals don't have specialists to be able to implement the full package of services. In terms of the hospitals that comply with the full national core standards, fully with the national core standards, we had only 2 hospitals that obtained an overall score of 91 and 80%, but it still did not meet the 100% compliance on extreme measures and more than 90% compliance on vital measures. Again, quite a stringent target to have set, which is why we didn't meet it. If we look at improving our staffing norms for our workforce on the next slide, on the next set of slides, our target was to have guidelines for human resources for health norms for district and specialized hospitals, and to have these developed. We have undertaken an auditing of services and activities of various cadres of health professionals per functional area, and then in some sampled hospitals, and thereafter the process commenced on the development of the standards, norms and standards, in terms of the WISEN methodology. The planned target for tertiary, regional and central hospitals oriented to the WISEN 2 methodology, we achieved that target, and we also achieved the last target of having 1,000 facilities benchmarked against the staffing normative guides, as I indicated earlier under the highlight section. With regards to our strategic objective to professionalize nursing training and practice through the implementation of the objectives of the nursing strategy, we've set ourselves 3 targets against our 3 performance indicators, and we've achieved all those targets, as we also indicated when we presented our quarter 4 report. So I'm happy to move to the next slides, honourable members. so that we look at our interventions underway to improve the quality of health infrastructure in South Africa. Here I've highlighted at the beginning that we've set ourselves a number of targets in terms of improving the quality of health infrastructure, and we actually have achieved all our targets there, except for the second target against the second indicator, where we achieved 217 against a target of 310. But in terms of what we set ourselves, we've achieved it. Now, if we go to the next slide looks at the indicators of number of blood alcohol reports produced and number of toxicology reports produced. As you will see there, we're falling short of our target, and this was largely related to the Johannesburg laboratory, which was overburdened and not having the capacity to deal with all the tests. But for the new financial year, there's been strategies put in place to deal with the backlogs, and by the end of quarter one we have already seen how we have chipped away at our backlogs, because the problem has been largely relieved at the Johannesburg Hospital. In terms of improving the management of health facilities through the Health Management and Leadership Academy, we've achieved our targets there, as I highlighted at the beginning. And our Knowledge Hub, which includes a web-based interactive information system, with a target of having a framework for a Knowledge Hub developed and approved, that target has also been achieved. So hopefully we will start to show results with our leadership capacity for our both hospitals and primary health care system. In terms of our other indicators, which relates to emergency medical services, we've had a number of targets there against the indicators, and in terms of the first four indicators, we've achieved them. We have a policy in place now. We have regulations for emergency centres which were drafted. We also have emergency services in mass gatherings, published regulations for emergency services in mass gatherings, published for public comment and implemented. It's been published for public comment. And in terms of developing a monitoring system to effectively measure turnaround time of tests conducted at forensic chemistry laboratories, we've also achieved that target in that our monitoring system has been developed. With regards to the last two indicators and targets, we have regulations reviewed and circulated for final perusal to members of the National Forensic Pathology Services Committee. So that target is in process of being achieved. And then the next one, which is to review and finalize the scope of practice guidelines for forensic pathology services, published and implemented. These guidelines have been reviewed, and it's also been circulated for final inputs by the Forensic Pathology Services Committee. In terms of the number of facilities that should have been designated to render sexual to deal with sexual assault, we aim to have 60 facilities designated, but we only achieved the target of 38 facilities designated, and we have put in place strategies to deal with that, which I will come to now, but we've achieved our target of regional training centres established. So if we go to the next slide and look at some of our improvement strategies that we've put in place, I've covered most of them. Regarding toxicology, there's now a new non-blue sky approach which has been used, and that will greatly help to reduce the backlog. What I want to speak to, though, is the the scope of practice guidelines for rendering forensic pathology services will be submitted now in the 2016-17 financial year, and letters were written to provincial heads to fast-track the identification of these facilities. And we're also developing the norms and standards for district and specialized hospitals, and resources will be mobilized from partner organizations to support the work at both national and provincial level. That finishes our program 5, which deals with hospital and tertiary health services and human resource development. And it brings us to our last program, which is program 6 on health regulation and compliance management. I'd like us to go to our strategic objectives and performance indicator table. And we can see here we've been working hard at this program so that if we look at all our targets against these indicators, we've actually achieved all of them listed on this page. And these relate to the establishment of SAPRA, the Institution of Regulatory Science, providing training, which must provide training, the review of the Occupational Health Legislative Framework, and the Occupational Health Cluster established and functional. We've achieved all the targets set in terms of those indicators. In terms of moving on to the next set of the next slide, looking at occupational health and compensation services through the development of one-stop service centers, that was a key strategic objective we set ourselves. We've managed to get local organizing committees established in two districts to support the process of setting up one-stop service centers, but it's still in progress. We've not fully achieved on that target. But in terms of the other three targets, we have gazetted legislation on a PISA, and it's out for public comments. We've had 4 public health entities and 6 statutory councils fully functional and compliant to good governance practices. And we know this because we've reviewed their functionality and reports were compiled showing that they are fully functional. And then with regards to having a standardized performance management system for board members developed and piloted, this was developed and implemented. If we go to the next set of performance indicators, here we've again had a number of targets and we've achieved all the targets. Targets relate to the proposed regulations for medical devices and IVDs, and call-off of high-risk medical devices and IVDs were finalized. We have had 56% of priority medicines registered, and we have had MOUs signed with between national departments and the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, and we have developed and finalized the regulations for cosmetic products. Now, in terms of the number of applications certified at MBOD as compensable disease claims, there we've had a bit of a challenge with only 7,295 being achieved against a target of 8,000. And in terms of the number of compensable disease claims paid by CCOD, other than pensioners, we have achieved 1,774 against a target of 3,000. But in terms of the other indicators and targets set, we've done very well and achieved those targets, specifically related to the monitoring of the performance and compliance of our entities, to legislative prescripts and developing reporting templates to enable feedback to the executive authority. Now, in terms of performance improvement strategies, the Institute of Regulatory Sciences will be implemented as part of Medicines Control Council, MMC and SAHPRA. In terms of the MBOD, the minister approved 24 additional medical doctors as members of the certification committee, and this will improve the number of certifications that are done. A track and trace project has been put in place at CCOD to find claimants and update documents. Therefore, this will advance us to better achieve our target. And there are also change management support interventions that were introduced at the CCOD. That finishes the regulation and compliance management. And it brings us then to our human resource management part of our annual report. Here we just want to highlight the fact that we the number of posts filled, the number of posts approved on the establishment, the total number of posts approved is 1881. We have 1748 posts filled. We have a vacancy rate, total vacancy rate of 3.5%, and we have 68 posts additional to the establishment. With regard to those 68 posts, 43 are in the process, 43 positions are in the process of being transferred to the Office of Health Standards Compliance. And then that brings us to our financial management part of our presentation, which I'll ask the CFO to present.
Thank you, Chair. Just to show, Chair, that on our expenditure per program, we've achieved a 99.4% expenditure rate. Most of our programs were within the 2.5% norm that we normally set for expenditure. In terms of our economic classifications, we spent all the funds on compensation, 85% on goods and services. And I'll talk now about some of the reasons for the underspend on goods and services transfers. We've transferred all the funds out to the conditional grants to provinces as well as to NGOs. And where we haven't transferred to NGOs, it would be as a result of them not submitting financial statements that could satisfy the SLAs. Capital, we had the first time that we actually got this kind of expenditure at 99% spent. We were normally lagging slightly behind in terms of the national infrastructure indirect grant. The one issue that we can highlight in terms of our expenditure was that the South African Demographic Health Survey ran over 3 years, and we couldn't also implement all the DRG at all the central hospitals. But that was a saving of about 18 million, of which we've requested a rollover from National Treasury and which was approved in this current financial year. So, and then just as a matter of completeness and linking to our previous meeting that we had to discuss the fourth quarter financials, conditional grants will be reflected, and you will see that in terms of expenditure, we spent 99.2% of our total conditional grant expenditure. And what I've shown in this slide is also the provincial rollovers. You will know that within our own expenditure, we only reflect what we have been allocated in terms of the DORA. But we felt that provincial rollovers also come into the equation. We've included them. And these are funds that then get to be part of the voted funds of provincial treasuries. And in any cases, if we don't discount the provincial rollovers, you will find that provinces would actually have overspent what we as national would have transferred out to them. But in this case, you can see that the training grant has got 100% spent, tertiary grant at 99%, HIV at 99.9%, the revive grant, I think this is the best rate of expenditure we've had in the last like 4 or 5 years, 96% spent, and even the NHI grant, the direct grant, is at 90.2% spent. If I'm not mistaken, last year we were at about 76% spent of this grant. So just to to conclude, Jay, on this one is that we say that the cohesion grants sit at 99.2% spent. Some of the reasons for the underspending on the revived grant would be in terms of delays in appointment in the Free State under this grant. You will know that they've had some, there was an allocation in the grant for capacity building. Free State was the province that lagged behind in this regard. Western Cape has some issues with the implementing agents, the Public Works Department, and they couldn't implement all the projects that they envisaged. On NHI, although the supply chain management deficiencies are still there, we've addressed most of them in terms of even our idle clinic interventions. Some few things like the delivery of uniforms and equipment contributed to that 10% under expenditure on the grants. Provinces again, most provinces did fairly well in terms of the expenditure. As I said, the provincial rollovers also assisted them. Gauteng and KZN spent 100% of their funds. The two provinces behind or slightly lower than the norms would be Northern Cape and the Western Cape. We've mentioned the issue of the implementing agent in the Western Cape using the Public Works. And there was also an issue with the Western Cape where we've transferred the indirect funding as direct funding in terms of the contracting of health professionals, and there was some delay or some shortcomings in terms of being able to recruit some of these health professionals. And then just going on to our indirect grant, this is the grant, Chair, that you'll remember, we transfer or we implement on behalf of provinces, so we keep the money at the National Department of Health. The NHI component was at 96% spent. And again, we've had, in terms of percentages, quite good acceleration of expenditure. Last year and the year before, we were struggling to get to 50% spend. But I think the program of appointing health professionals and GP contracting has really matured in the last financial year. The revive component was actually fully spent. A small difference there. I must say that, as I reported in the previous meeting, that we've had quite a big adjustment of 300 million on this grant. So obviously this also assisted us in terms of expanding our total budget. The HPV component was a 79% spend, and the underspending amount was about 41 million. And this was the only matter of emphasis on our financials was the fact that there was an underspend of 41 million on that. And unfortunately, it relates back to the submission of claims by provinces. We rely on provinces to claim the cost debt from national. If they don't do that, then unfortunately we're not able to process those payments in time. We try to address it in this financial year, but provinces seem to have difficulty in separating it from their voted expenditure. But we've assisted some of the provinces to put in some system so they could identify the cost and claim it back from us. So we probably will see in the current year that the claims will only be processed in this third quarter, and our second quarter expenditure might also be low for this financial year. Chair, then just in conclusion, we've reviewed the NHI framework, and we're also including idle clinics in there now. You remember that initially it was only the pilot districts were included. We strengthened our evaluation and monitoring of infrastructure projects by appointing on-site engineers at provinces, and also strengthening their project management support units. Where possible, provinces would request for rollovers. It's a very difficult area, seeing that we have to show commitment and orders and of an infrastructure nature before Treasury considers rollovers, but that process is ongoing. And we're also trying to address some of the challenges in our current APP. So, Chair, let me leave it at that on the financials.
Thank you. Honourable Minister.
Chairperson, just before members come in for questions, I just want to clarify a few things in addition. On page 16, yes, I'm painfully aware, Chairperson, that this report is up to the end of March. but some of the things are very important even for your work. For that reason, especially the issue of drug stockouts, which has been in the front line of papers a long time. I just want to report that issue of electronic stock management system is now in all the clinics in the country. It's no longer, as is reported there, that we have reached a certain number of clinics and hospitals. The SVS, this stock visibility system, is in all the clinics, and also the chronic, the central chronic medicine dispensing, it shows 396. I must tell you that that number has doubled ever since, which means more and more people are receiving their medicines at home. I just wanted to clarify that so that you don't have to wait for next year to get the actual state of affairs. On page 29, on page 29, the issue that the CEO was speaking about of staff rotation is going to be a very big problem we are dealing with about policy. I'm talking here about reducing neonatal mortality. That's an area of very high specialty. You need very highly trained nurses if you are going to reduce mortality from babies who are born prematurely, because we have got a very high rate of premature birth, most probably because of the extraordinarily high prevalence of HIV/AIDS in our country. So if babies are dying of asphyxia due to prematurity, you need highly trained nurses which know how to ventilate the baby. Now, our weakness here is that because of that, we train the nurses. And when they are very good, unfortunately, I'm sure, Chairperson, you were also a nurse, so was the CEO. COO, so both of you will have the same experience. They rotate them. Nurses rotate. And we've got an argument with chief nursing officers or nursing managers whether to produce the best nurse, you rotate them to know everything, or you make them specialize. Now, I've already met the committee, or confidential committee on of inquiry on maternal mortality. They are really asking us to have a very serious change of policy. It's going to be impactful, because what you mean is that if this nurse works in the PIDS ward, in the neonatology, she must never live there until retirement, because she must be here. That's why I'm saying it's a very tricky issue, because she has been trained, she knows how to ventilate babies, she can make them live, and if she leaves, the other one will start from the beginning. Now, I agree, Honorable Newman Dabak, I could see it doesn't excite you very much. That's why I wanted to highlight you. Oh, I see. But the chairperson there hasn't been there. Yes. Now, we are going to have, as a country, to make a decision which one is the best. Keep a nurse there for the rest of their life and let them know one thing, or let them know. I'm saying so because it says that that type of specialization works well in countries with lots of money, who have got lots of money to hire more nurses, put them to specialize. That in the context of Africa, nurses must be generalists, because they must know everything, because they can work in rural areas, etc. So we haven't yet made up our mind about that, but I'm just trying to tell you that it's one of the impediments of doing that job. On page 34, this issue of HPV vaccine, which also was reflected on page 80 by the CFO, it's quite a problem. I feel very bad about it, because we immunize kids for HPV with HPV vaccine twice a year, in March and in October. We immunize these kids. I'm quite sure if you go to our schools and say how many kids are immunized, you'll find them. But the reporting here becomes difficult, because we then depend on provinces submitting invoices. What you are seeing here when we report to you is about information we got. And if they don't submit them, you can't write there that we'll spend this money. But the young girls have been immunized. They are there. because we go and get them in school. It's not that we fetch them in the villages. They are at school, you just go there, start the immunization process and go away. But then when you must get information which you must report to Parliament, you have to phone various people and NGOs that provided service and service providers to say bring your invoices, and we end up coming here to report a lower figure because we would not have received all those. I just wanted to clarify that. Then page 38. Yes, on the issue of MDR-TB, Chairperson, you are aware that treatment of MDR-TB around the whole world, the success rate is at best 60%, meaning when you treat people who have got multi-drug-resistant TB, you expect only, it's not 60 actually, it's 40 globally, it's not 60, the cure rate. And now we have just introduced a new drug called Bitavilin. It's extremely expensive, unfortunately. But just to report that 60% of all the people who are on Bitavilin globally are in our country. So we are leaders in this, and we are hoping in the next subsequent reports we are going to be reporting a different story, because we have put more people on Bitavilin, regardless of its expenses, because we believe that is one of the ways in which we are going to defeat multi-drug resistant TB. Page 61. Chairperson, this issue of forensic pathology services, which you know is always a problem about our forensic laboratory. As you know, they do three functions. They measure blood alcohol, which is worrying us. It's going higher and higher. In other words, almost every year, the number of people who, especially drunken driving, the number of people who submit, where samples have to be submitted to these laboratories for drunken driving, that number is increasing year by year. We even have to open, you remember we had only three laboratories in the whole country for that purpose, here in Cape Town, in Pretoria, and in Johannesburg. We had to open another one in Durban from April this year to try and defeat that, which means more and more people are involved in this unwanted practice of drinking and driving. It's a problem for the country, and solving it by increasing laboratories is just a stopgap measure, but it's not something we're comfortable with. The second issue, the second thing they do is food testing, where municipalities must collect food from various saving points like restaurants to test if it's healthy. The last one is toxicology. Now, this is the one I want to explain, Chairperson, because we will never win in terms of targets. We'll never, even if you give us the next 50 years, we'll never win. We'll never reach our targets unless we change the policies. This is what the CEO called a blue sky approach. I just want Dr. Carter to explain it. South Africa is following a blue sky approach, which many countries have changed. It doesn't work. Blue sky approach presupposes that any human being who dies, you have got to find the cause of death. Unless you find it, you don't lose that file, so you won't count that as a target. Now, it's not always possible anywhere in the world to find the cause of death of everybody. It has never happened in the history of human beings. There are many unsolved cases. Now, in other countries, they've got a deadline that if by this time this case is not solved, we close it and we pack it. Maybe we may reopen it if after 10 years or so something comes. In South Africa, we park it there as an unsolved case, and it's still counted in our targets here that we have not achieved. The second thing in the blue sky approach is that in toxicology, Chairperson, many countries put together a group of chemicals or poisons which they believe are commonly used to kill human beings or for suicide, etc. They put them there, and they test them. If they can't find the cause of death or they can't detect a chemical among that group, then they stop. Now, the blue sky approach in South Africa is that we don't have any group of chemicals. We search for everything and everything. In other words, anything that is a chemical that can ever kill a human being, we search for them. And if we don't find, we don't lose that fire. We keep on searching. So you'll never reach your targets in that manner. Now, we are going to have to change the law and the act. So we've put together the people from the police, the forensic laboratories, etc. They agree with us that this blue sky approach doesn't work. And it needs to be. Maybe Dr. Carter can just explain a little bit. Because otherwise, Parliament will keep on asking us, in this area, you have never met our targets. You are never going to meet them. Even if you give us 100 years, that target will never be met. It's just practically not possible. Maybe you must explain how the various forensic people who deal with forensics say this problem must be solved through the laws.
So, Chairperson, we have a National Forensic Pathology Committee. That committee consists of all the forensic pathology specialists from all the universities in the country. The chairperson of that committee is a Professor Gert Simon, and that committee meets on a regular and a quarterly basis. Included, included in that is the forensic specialist from the South African Police Services, and they've also consulted with the South African Justice, Department of Justice, and they also have a specialist, one of the only accredited laboratories in the country at one of our universities, although he's not part of our forensic services, but he's the head of the only accredited private pathology service for toxicology from the University of Pretoria. So he's part of this committee. So the recommendation which Minister is referring to comes from that committee, where the committee is saying that the international best practice is that you don't have a blue sky approach. You understand what are those chemicals, whether they be drugs or otherwise, that could cause chemical death, either due to poisoning, accidental or non-accidental, homicide, murder, or whatever the cause might be, where somebody dies and you're not sure what the cause of death is and you think it might be one or other chemical. But you don't test for everything under the sun. You test for those things that internationally is known to be the most common chemicals that could cause death. So what they are currently in the process of is to ensure that they develop such a short list, looking at the international, local and international experience, going back for the last number of years to understand what are those chemicals that can cause death, and then to test for those to start off with. And once you have made the decision that you have tested for every known chemical that has caused death or has been used to cause death, you then close the case at that point, but you don't destroy the samples in case you want to go back and you want to retest that sample in the future. So that is the approach which Minister is referring to.
If we lose that case, then we'll tell you that we've met our target. Then you won't be angry with us. If we don't do that, that target will never be met because the case will still be closed forever. And so that's exactly what he's talking about. Now, the page 67. And 68. You are aware that the CCOD was here. I'm happy to report, Chairperson. The reason that we didn't meet our targets there on page 67 and 68 about paying people for CCOD. Just to remind you, Chairperson, we are dealing with ex-mine workers here who we don't know. We are searching for them. And the last time we were here, we reported to you that we are going to Lesotho, Swaziland, etc. We have just done so. And we have just completed a sort of electronic track and find system, which we are now using. And they've just mapped, and they found that an overwhelming majority in terms of that track and file are in Lesotho, then followed by Mozambique and Swaziland. And we are searching for them. We are now in a process with the help of the World Bank to organize a meeting of all the ministers in those countries put them together, show them that track and find system, try to work with us to find these people, because we have discovered something new, which when we met with the CCOD, we didn't tell you. That the ex, because we didn't know about it, now we know. The ex-mine workers are not only owed money from compensation, even their pensions, they never knew about them. Their pensions and all that, when we calculate, they are owed about 30 billion rand from various pension funds around the country, because if you are an ex-mine worker, you go home, you are. So we believe this CCOT track and find is going to unveil things that we've never known about in this country, of people working and being thrown away in rural areas. It's a very beautiful system. If you want, we can come and demonstrate it, because now we have mapped that with the track and find. And all that is left is to find them or find their relatives, pay them the compensation, and once we do so, we'll be able to go to all the various pension systems in the country and say, we have found the person, start paying them what you owe them. So that is the track and find system. But as I'm saying, for us here not to reach our target, the money is there, but you can't pay until you find the person or you find the family. Thank you.
Honorable members, that was the presentation. Those are the areas of clarity that Minister clarified in addition. Questions, clarities, comments? Honorable Volmik, Honorable Ndaba, Honorable Maisel, and Honorable Khoza. In that order.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you to the Minister and to the team for that presentation. I just have a few questions. First, just stepping outside of this, I recently had a great privilege of visiting the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital in Joburg, and it was really an incredible experience. And I know the Minister's been there, and many of us have been there, but just walking around the hospital, you know, everything is still under plastic. You can smell the paint; it hasn't yet launched. And I remember going into the renal dialysis unit and seeing all these renal dialysis machines, and thinking to myself, this is incredible. This is where so many lives of our children are going to be saved. But when I spoke to the CEO afterwards and the team, she was saying that there were certain commitments with regards to the operational expenses at the hospital that had been made by the minister, our minister, as well as the Minister of Finance. And of course, there were concerns around this. There's an amount between now and the end of the financial year, and then another amount going forward that was even larger. And they've raised their capital, of course, through donation to establish the hospital. And it isn't technically a government hospital, but it is our hospital. It symbolizes something that all of us are part of. And so the question is, because I haven't seen it anywhere in the budget and I haven't come across it, that commitment that was made in terms of the operating expenditure, is that going to go there? Because that hospital has to work. It has to work. And so that's the first question. The second one relates to, you know, something I saw when I was walking through the hospital down at the bottom. There's a statement there. It says, quote, there can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children, unquote, and that was by Tata Madiba in 1995. And this day, to this day, that still needs to bind us, because we've got a common mission of caring for the health of our children. And that finds that form in the health department's objectives, certainly as the CEO indicated in your program 3 in particular. And in fairness, you've done very well and need to be commended. But there's still more that needs to be done. And if you look, for example, at your child under 5 case fatality rate with regards to acute severe malnutrition, it's 8.9%, which is beyond the target of 10%, but again, still not good enough. And we need help. And so on that, my second question is, there's a global initiative called the Scaling Up of Nutrition, or SUN, that many countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, have signed up to, but we haven't yet signed up to it. It has a vision of seeing the elimination of all forms of malnutrition being eliminated by 2030. And many countries, again, in our SADC family are signed up to it. It's galvanized political will, but our country is conspicuously absent. The question is, why haven't we yet signed up to that? And when are we going to? The next questions and my last questions relate to the finances. And with regards to the entities, one of the entities that presented before us, of course, is the SAMRC, the Medical Research Council. And when we looked at their finances, they showed us that, in fact, if you look at the year-on-year budget allocation, even though they received, there was a 40% increase in 2015-2016, in 2016-17 that goes down to 5%, and the next year it goes down to -7%. And we obviously were very concerned about that, because this is a national asset. We need to protect our Medical Research Council. And in their notes they say, over the MTF, the baseline allocation declines and increase at a nominal rate. This trend will not allow the SAMRC to continue with flagship projects which have merit and will impact negatively on leverage funding opportunities. And when we pushed them on this, because they said they have tried, they've spoken to Treasury and to yourselves, and they've come up with a solution, but when you pushed them on this, they said they needed an additional 20 million rand for those flagship projects and an additional 30 million rand for the leverage funding opportunities, which are good return on investment for us publicly. And so the question is, will that money be extra money? Could that be made available to them? My second last question relates to the financing of the NHLS. We, of course, know that there are huge concerns with regards to the NHLS in terms of the financing, and it's to do with the provincial arrangements around payment. We know, for example, that KZN owes them large amounts of money, they owe Gauteng, etc. And so the question I have is, what we raised with them yesterday, is it time we relook at the funding model and actually accumulate the funds of the NHLS into a national conditional grant? And I know this has been tried and it was pushed back from the provinces with regards to the equitable share, etc. But the problem is that money comes out of the equitable share anyway. The 2.5 billion owed by KZN is going to have to come out of their budget. We don't have money to bail them out. And so the question is, can't we push towards creating a centralized fund where the 6.4 billion or so of revenues from the NHLS go into that fund, stay there, and are used to pay service providers, used to actually pay the NHLS through services rendered. We can have service level agreements at the provincial level so that we don't actually go beyond what we is capable of. In terms of, you know, obviously if you sign a blank check, there'll just be far too many diagnostic services. But the point is that if we can control it nationally, then we won't run into the problems we face. The last question I have is one that I think has pained all of us in this committee this week, and that is the Auditor General's findings. And looking at the health sector, the 7.7 billion rand of irregular expenditure, this is an astronomical amount, Honourable Chairperson. I mean, it is thousands and thousands and thousands of health care workers that could be employed with that equivalent amount of money. We actually did some math here, and you could use that money to pay for 32,000 bursaries for 3 years for our students. And if you look at the problems in our campuses, just to put into perspective how much money this is, you could almost resolve that issue. 7.7 billion rand across the health sector. Now, in fairness, the Department of Health has only a regular expenditure of 2.9 million, which is only a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. So you've done extremely well as a national department. But as the national department, you still have custodial responsibility over the health sector, as do we, as Parliament, from the legislative and oversight perspective. And 7.7 billion rand on our collective watch is simply not acceptable. What can we do? How can we put our heads together to ensure that this doesn't reoccur and, in fact, that there are consequences? Thank you.
Honourable Ndebele.
Thanks, Chair. I want to congratulate the department also for getting the unqualified audit report. But, Chair, I think I've got... We've got a concern with the regressing of the two provinces, which is Limpopo and Northwest. So we just want to check with the department what plans do they have in terms of assisting them. You know, because I think if you remember, Chair, at one time Limpopo was once put under administration, and we have seen ourselves when we were doing our oversight in Northwest, we were worried about many things. So I think it's important that the national department must look at improving the situation in Northwest and Limpopo in terms of their financials. My second one, Chair, is with regards to Program 3, HIV and AIDS. I think there's one program, Honourable Minister, that you have launched of test and treat, which I'm proud of, and we are getting a good feedback even from the communities. I think with the results, we need to check each and every province on how are they progressing with that program that you have launched, because the feedback that we're getting from our communities is very positive. Most of our people are very much happy, because it's no longer like discriminating like it before with regards to the CD4 count issue. So everybody is giving us a good feedback. When coming to the issue of the nurses that you spoke about, when I said, are you right? No, it's true. We are correct to say, I think it's not with regards to PIDS only, but it's also with regards to ICU. We're in a Free State, I think it's Free State, where they were, whether it's Free State, between Free State and Northwest, there was one hospital where they complained about nurses who went to train for ICU, but some of them, they go out and not work in the country and go work out of the country. And some of them, they were saying they've got that specialty in their institution, but the problem is that post is not there. So I think it's one thing also that we need to address. I want to agree with you that let's leave the nurses that are specializing, Honorable Minister, let's leave them. I think it must be a police of whatever, but keep them to specialize in the field where they've studied for, rather than making them rotate in the hospital, going to a general ward. It will not assist or benefit us, but at least if they are left in a ward where they are specializing, that will bear a fruit for the health services. There's one concern that I'm having. I think even yesterday we were having that concern with regards to NHLS. It's the issue of medical technologist training. There's high fail rate, but it's not because the students don't understand their field or what they are doing. The issue is the board, the examination board, the medical examination board for medical technologists. It's been a problem for a long time. Even the CEO herself, she told us that she was once affected by the same problem. And after our intervention with our discussion with her as the portfolio committee, that I think something needs to be done there. And she said she appointed one senior manager to go to sit in the board. And the results, they've improved a little bit. But she said to us yesterday, she's not sure if next year the results will improve or whatsoever. But the question that we are having as the portfolio committee is that who appoints that examination board? And if it's the prerogative of the minister, what we felt yesterday is that I'm sure there's the need for the reviewal of that board. Whether the reviewal is disbandment and appointing new board, but I think yesterday we felt maybe the disbandment of the board will be a solution, so that you appoint new board members, so that you can see what will be the improvement. Because I'm sure those people who are there, they've been there for donkey years. Hence, they are blocking any black child who wants to enter in that field. The black students, they are just used as employees. But in terms of them finishing their profession or their course, somebody is blocking them. So I think it's a concern that we've been having for the past 2 years as the portfolio committee. So yesterday, I think we have agreed as members that if it's the prerogative of the minister, that means then that board needs to be disbanded so that we can see if a black child can be given an opportunity to pass in that field. Because obviously you can't be you can't write your theory and pass and do your practical every day, and then, but at the end of the day, when the board is supposed to assess you, you fail. And most of the students, they are even deciding not to continue with that profession. And as they were presenting their reports yesterday, they have shown us that there is a decline in terms of a recruitment of medical technologists. So, let me pass that on. With regards to the Auditor General's report, the last page. With the recommendation, the root causes should be addressed where the Auditor General has made recommendations. I'm sure what you can we need to get from the department on the progress that we have made with regards to these recommendations, because I think this is critical for us and very much important. Test and fit and that. I open you my set as a cover now.
Honourable Maisel.
Thank you, Chair. My first question would be why the lack of skills which contributes to child mortality. Skills can be acquired, and if we say it is because of lack of skills, then let's acquire the skills and solve the problem. Unless it's part of the fees must fall. There is no money to get the medical students to graduate. But if it's a matter of skills, let's find ways and means of combating that. Now, we have exceeded our target of distributing condoms, both ways, Femi, DOMS, and whatever. But the increase in infection is spiking. There is something we are doing wrong. Obviously, it's not because we are doing something right. So let's sit down and forget about maybe other theories and influences from somewhere, and just see what happens to our children. What it is that we are not doing well to protect them from this. There must be something that we can sit down and strategize on and do it correct. We can't keep on throwing money on condoms and things like that and mantras and adverts. And meanwhile, we are not. This every year we talk about this and it keeps on increasing. We are failing somewhere. Let's find out why this thing is happening. You say that 5-year-olds and are dying of pneumonia. Maybe if we try to find the social determinants of that, maybe it may be just be because a lot of these people stay in informal settlement and overcrowded, and so they is cause infection and things like that. If we can just really find out what is the cause of this thing. Well, maybe there is a cause, but it wasn't explained in the notes, in the presentation. What is the causal agents, or what it is that makes the children to be vulnerable to pneumonia? So, if we can find that out, I think maybe we can sort it out. And it is a very serious indictment that in this time and era in our country, children still die of malnutrition.
it is a serious indictment. It's not the Department of Health. They don't feed the children. It's not. But you see, they report that they die. So they must tell those people who bring the children to that hospital to die and tell them what to do to avoid this type of thing. I mean, we went to Pretoria and realized that the incidence of acute malnutrition is increasing. And it's people not from outside, but children from the informal settlement. And I think that is an indictment. We are talking about children here, which are the future. And if they die of simple things like malnutrition, and I think even in the clinics, when the child is there for examination and the weight and losing weight, they don't care about trying to find out what is the problem. They just do things as usual. Maybe let's try and keep an eye on that to try and see what it is that can be done. And the screening of the learners at school, health barriers to learning, I don't think is progressing apace. You may hear that it's been done, it is happening, but when you go to the ground, you find that maybe these reports are over-exaggerated. It's not what it's supposed to be. And whoever is doing it is not doing it, because we are on the ground sometimes, and when we do our oversight thing, we find out now it's ephemeral. It's not really concrete. And HPV vaccine universally available, or is it manufactured here, or we import it, or is it universally available? Or if it is, so fine. Or if it's not, why? Why not? And what is the effect of DDT on humans? And the residual DDT.
Can the Honourable Minister explain this question of HPV? Because we have never complained about the shortage. I just want to know the context of the question about universal availability of HPV. Whether it's in connection with the understanding that there was a shortage or what, because never...
I just want to know whether it is universally available, just a question, and whether it is manufactured or it is imported. Because important is that if vaccines are made locally, then they would be cheaper and more available, readily available, unlike if they are imported. Okay, let's leave it at that. It's just a question for now. And the chemicals about testing salt in food, it is said that it's because the chemicals are not available for doing this. It's in the report. So what is the source not able to supply the necessary quantities, or what is happening? I just want to know. It's intriguing to say that we can't do it because there is not availability of chemicals. So maybe we should try, and maybe we'll explain why. Now, the refurbishment of hospitals, I think we have been talking about this year in and year out, and about the grants that are given for this, and the grants are not being spent or something like that, underspending of grants. Meanwhile, the hospitals are not being refurbished. And I think there was a good example in Pretoria District Hospital. They are doing it themselves, and they say it's cheaper. No, they are doing it in-house, and it's cheaper, and they are succeeding. And we were impressed when we were there to see what they are doing. Maybe we should just follow their example. Maybe it could help, you know, instead of following some other direction. If we follow that, maybe just find out why, what it is that make them to succeed. Well, the money about the pension, we are happy that you said the money for the pensions that they owe the people for years are there. Now, what was it? What made them not to pay the people if they have their money and they know they owe them? Was it fraud or what? You know, I mean, they knew the old people, their funds, and they didn't want to look after. Maybe it's because of the past regime. It's not our fault. But thanks, you are beginning to correct the wrongs of the past. The other problem is robots. We were trying to look for them very carefully and very strenuously, and we didn't seem to find them. Some maybe they were not there where we were looking, but it looks like they need to be investigated. There must be something somewhere which does not tally. Now, maybe the next time we will be giving strict figures and verifiable that they are there, here they are, this group here, this group there, because the explanations we got, it doesn't make sense. Okay, now, something very important also. The department has got a campaign of screening TB in the mining mining communities and things like that, because they are the source of infection, by the way. So they are not just limited there. And we heard something like it's a private thing, and they are not, the department is not allowed to go in there and screen the people. It's a private territory. But I think medicine or health has got no boundaries, especially in South Africa. So if the enthusiasm with which the department wants this thing to be done, and it's not done because it's a private area, and that private area is infecting the people outside of that area, it defeats the purpose. So maybe something...
Jefferson, again, you're talking about a mine where Department of Health was not allowed to go in and screen people. That's what you...
It is in some report somewhere that it's a private area, the department is not allowed.
In the mine?
Yeah, the mining area. It's a mining hospital, I don't know. But it is very frightening to hear such things, although those people are a source of infection to the communities outside of the mining areas. So I don't know. But there's a question that will be explained. I mean, I don't have the answers. You have the answers. You'll explain why. If that is objective, is reality, if that is the truth. But if it's not, there's no harm. Somebody wrote some report somewhere and we misunderstood it. Okay, and I wish we would have misunderstood it. And that's why I said something must be done for that, because you can't have a program on one side, a campaign actually, and be sabotaged by somebody saying, I won't get another. It doesn't make sense to me. Thank you very much.
Honorable Kosa.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank to the department for the presentation. It was so informative. I'm joining the other members, Chairperson, by congratulating or commending the department for achieving unqualified audit opinion. But I want to talk about it, Chair, that we it's a concern that there are provinces that are still dragging behind. And I want also to challenge the department to not be comfortable with that dancing floor. The dance floor I'm referring to, unqualified audit. They need to move a step ahead to clean audit. I think that it's serious. They've been dancing there. I'm saying it's comfortable because for the past 5 years, they're just dancing there. It seems to be comfortable. So we're challenging them to move forward and to the last lap, which is clean audit. We'll be comfortable and happy about that. The other issue I want to raise, Chairperson, is with regard to the AG has highlighted some weaknesses in the reliability of data presented in the programs. That is in page 90 from the report. I want to check with the department if they've got plans in place to improve such reliability, and if yes, what strategies are they intending to use? The third issue, Chair, there's a serious challenge with regard to the health professionals such as doctors and nurses and many others in the country, more especially those that are leaving the system. What are the turnaround strategies that the department has to ensure that such skills are retained, we don't lose them too? You know, the Honourable Minister has just indicated, I'm not saying that the chairperson must go back to nursing, but these are some other issues where we need to check as to how do we retain such necessary skills. and next to me, the fourth issue, chairperson, is with regard to the 322 ID clinic. It's of an interest to me if it's possible to know where are these ID clinics situated, so that one given a time can visit to acclimatize with myself as to what is really an ID clinic, so that I'll be able to be assisting the constituency where I'm coming from as to how do they improve to that type of an ID clinic. And lastly, Chairperson, is the comment, the last comment by the Honourable Minister with regard the food testing. I think it's a good initiative, but the challenge, Honourable Minister, is with regard to the capacity in municipalities for officials to deliver, because they really need a maximum assistance municipalities, because even where in they have capacity, sometimes they are scared to implement bylaws, even if there is capacity. So we need a dialogue in that regard, so that they be assisted to be able to perform. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable
Sekunenye.
Thank you, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Actually, I'm just going to speak to one or two things. The content is so much, tried to absorb. Maybe one of the things, I just an observation, is that I see quite a number of instances we're developing policy or developing something. Maybe just to make examples, like the developing and implementing the HIV counseling and testing policy, developing and implementing HIV prevention strategy. Are you really developing or maybe reviewing the existing ones? Because I'm just imagining that you must have had these policies even before now. So it's just by way of really getting clarity as to whether these are really just being developed. But the other thing is the issue of the ideal clinic. Maybe I'll just pick on this. My colleagues have mentioned the fact that we've recently gone out on provincial oversight visits. What do you find maybe as a department as challenges? Because one of the big challenges that we came across is the issue of infrastructure. The clinics, the infrastructure in some of the clinics is such that even though they have been designated, you find that because of the infrastructure that they don't have really adequate facilities in terms of infrastructure. If they have, the department is aware that there are these challenges, because it's happening at provincial level and it could pose some problem. And then maybe one other thing that I would like to just find out about, I am quite happy that there is mention of mental health facilities and rehabilitation and disability. How huge is this challenge? Because, I mean, on face value, one really sees that there is a serious challenge. Fortunately, a lot of hospitals, especially district hospitals, you find that they do have mental health wards and all that. But generally in the country, do we have, but how bad is the situation? I won't say how good, but I'll say how bad is the situation with regard to rehab services and mental health facilities. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Just a few questions, some few comments. When we conducted the oversight, the concept of the ideal clinic, I think I want to raise that, Honourable Minister. We conducted our oversight in all three provinces, focusing mainly on the pilot sites. And we pick up that there is still a challenge. Yes, they are in one of the pilot sites in Free State. There are park homes, but there is a challenge of which maybe it's a challenge right across, the challenge of the shortage of staff in all disciplines. We know we can't be unfair to expect you to change that situation overnight, but in Tshwane, there is one hospital, CHC, where some of the disciplines in health, in particular radiographer, is working under very serious, I've just forgotten the name of the, under very serious conditions. She's a radiographer, she's a clerk, she is to transport those patients, she is a porter. I'm saying there are those challenges. But in some of the ideal clinics, there is only one clinic. There is only one Standard Mubabe, yes. There is only one institution where we left there in confidence. In fact, we said that must be upgraded into the CHC. It's the only institution where we said this is a structure of an ideal clinic. I think it's in Soshanguve. Yes. Within that one must be upgraded. That's what was our it must be upgraded into a CHC. But with others, yeah. With the others, we still have, and we're not downplaying the fact that there is work that is being done by the National Department of Health. But with that, I want to couple that with the revite. Tell us how many institutions in which provinces? Because it's only in one, in Free State, Thabo Futsanyana, where we saw a contractor on site. That's where we're confident. Yes, we commend the National Department of Health because there is what is called a park home.
Yeah,
a park home that is really up to standard. But there, the other area where we think that there are challenges in these pilot sites, war boards have been, but government structures. It is in. And we're so excited, we feel humbled. We felt humbled, in fact. One clinic where we were received by a full complement of a clinic committee. Full complement. Excited that we were there. I don't know whether it's because it's adults, but you could see that they have got a passion on the work that they are assigned to do. Same applies with Wizen. There's something very interesting that has been raised in Tshwane, in one of the institutions, that Wizen is focused, that is the observation of that doctor. Wizen is focusing on the clinical side of health. So Not that they disagree with Wiseman, but it's there, it's the observation, the weakness is that if focus is only on the clinical side of health, they would have appreciated that if both there's a balance, clinical and the administration. On the issue of in page slide 43, the screening of mental health is very general. I would appreciate that if it can be unpacked. Maybe it won't be possible now. In the public service, there was once an article about the impact of mental illnesses in the public service and the stigma attached to that. So that is why my question is on can it be unpacked? Where was that? Even ourselves here, we are to be screened. Yeah. Nobody in this house can be confident that he or she will never suffer or is not suffering from any mental disorder. Everybody. So that I think is important. I know his views. I'm not going to be intimidated about that. Sexual transmitted infections can never be only the responsibility of the Department of Health. All of us, including parents. Why is it that I think what I would encourage the Department of Health is to, well, working together with the basic education I'm partly responding to the question from Honourable Maestro asking what the department is doing. It's a societal matter. Everybody. I don't think it will be fair to ask that. The last two is that what is the impact of the fees must fall? What will be the impact of fees must fall? The Department of Health in the years to come. I agree, Honourable Minister, that nurses or health workers with specialities, in particular nurses, because it's not that it has not been done. Maybe it's because now the population has increased. We know for a fact that those nurses that have been trained on advanced midwifery will rotate within maternity. They will never go out. So I do think that is going to be important, but we must couple that with our recruitment. Maybe we have charged the entities that they must also go out, Medical Research Council in particular, they must also go out as National Health Laboratory Services, that they must, in their recruitment, they must also go out to learners to explain what is meant by National Health Laboratory Services, so that we're able to tap those skills. We were told a very interesting observation that has been made by the South African Medical Research Council on the decline on the cancer of the esophagus. And they are attributing that to restrictions that were there coming from Dr. Nkosazana Zuma on tobacco. Decline, yes, they said, among other things, that decline has been so, the restrictions and the regulations which are there, they've encouraged, they said, no, We must ensure that we assist the department, even the sugar, because we may not see it now, but down the line, we will then be able to...
Chairperson, did they talk about esophageal cancer or lung cancer?
No, it was only the cancer of the esophagus. They didn't go to the cancer, the lung. The lungs. In the Office of the Health Standard Compliance, we got a report that they've only got 44 transfers. And you have said it's 43. Which one is correct? I think they said 44 and you said 43. I've gone back to the report on the transfers from the Department of Health. I think some of the questions have been asked by honourable members, but thank you very much for this on the issues of CCOD, of the thing that has been revealed now. And I hope communities will really understand, because it then means it's no more about, but it's also about pensions. And I've always been asking myself, what then becomes the role of, maybe I'm delving into another difficult environment, the role of mine owners, not bosses, those that own mines, in this whole challenge that we are having, what then become their role. We will break for just a comfort break to allow you to rearrange your see who's going to respond on what, and then we'll come back and get the response from the department. Thank you very much.
I'm not Now, I was thinking all of them, which was especially the statistics, we all the
No.
We are all old. We are in a situation where we're not young people. We're rescued because it's a That's the first thing. The second thing, we are all
here.
And now she also has grown that. No, at our age, most of us, either you are diabetic or hypertension. I was being calling. I saw the over the weekend. Why am I not telling you?
May we start, Honourable Minister? I know this discussion of permit. Hi, can I protect it? Can we? Yes, Honourable Minister, we will then give over to your team.
Chairperson, I'll start first.
Thank you.
I'll start first. The team will follow. The first question from Honourable Volming is the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital. We all agree. Chairperson, I was just reminding my team when we were meeting that this is the first time that we are having this type of NDT in South Africa. They were all learning as we were discussing how we are going to carry it on, because I did have an opportunity of meeting Madiba about it, especially when we were going to do sort training. I was not there. My late colleague, Dr. Mlifis Fuller, went for the sort training, and we briefed him. We have got the only children's hospital here is Red Cross, but it was built differently. It was built by the state, and it has got a trust, etc. Now, this one was built by Madiba. In other words, he raised funds. But he said it's for all the children of our country and the neighboring countries. At some stage, they wanted to run it like a private hospital. For instance, Mediclinic was managing it. And I warned them that if that happens, it will no longer be what Madiba was talking about. Because children of the poor won't come there. Only people with medical aid will come. And that could not have been Madiba's intention. So for that reason, we agreed that the running cost must be borne by the state. Now the difficulty here, which Dr. Carter is negotiating, is that we know the model of running Red Cross, the governance, because it was built with state funds, it has got the trust that raised funds, etc. Now the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital, the state didn't build it, but it's going to run it. And the people who are the board, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, who are the board, they still want to have a say. So you want to put a new model. And then there are also issues of the Auditor General. How do you transfer money to an entity which is not clearly the state but is going to help the nation? Now, all those issues have not been cleared. For instance, there was an issue of staff on which the members of that board and the university were not seeing each other, were not at, you know, having on the same page. Because the university has got the method of hiring staff, and they wanted to use a different method which you use in the private sector. So we had to, yeah, because whichever staff report there, they must still report to the university in the same way that we do in Red Cross and all the other big hospitals. Now, our thing is an interesting model because it will teach us how to approach, you know, health from many different points of view. But we are committing to help them with the running cost. The only thing which I'm confessing is that we have told them to ask them to lower the expectations a little bit in the beginning. In other words, the number of beds they wanted to open, because of the economic situation in which are, cannot be as high as it was in the beginning. In other words, we're asking them that is going to be a big, big nightmare. It can't just be a big bang approach. And that's also being discussed. The issue of malnutrition, Honorable Volming. Yes, we are looking into this issue very closely. I'm not sure about our not signing the elimination, because in the sustainable development goals, it's there. And we have adopted the sustainable development goals. I'll come to it later because I saw a question about it. And the MRC budget, I'm painfully aware that we are trying our best to make the MRC a world-class research organization. Actually, it is. But you are aware that we are still lagging behind in the whole country. That a certain percent, I think 0.1%, 2 of the GDP must be used for research. We're not yet there, but between the Department of Science and Technology and us, we are really trying our best to make the MRC become a flagship in our country. So here and there we'll struggle, but it's our intention really. The NHLS, the funding of NHLS, Honorable Volming, I'm sure I thought I've already discussed this matter to yourself, that I have been discussing with Treasury for the past 3 years and the provinces about this. I even went to the National Budget Council, where the Minister of Finance meets with all the MECs to lobby them that this funding of NHLS is wrong and it has caused us disasters. When you talk about irregular expenditure, I was just making a comment here to the Chief Financial Officer, because we once struggled with the Auditor General, where he accused us of a irregular expenditure of 300 million. Because money, you know, the manner in which NHL is funded, I said it openly, is wrong. It's wrong. You can't fund a social services structure in the manner in which it is. The DG is giving money. She sends that money into the provincial treasuries as a conditional grant. The provincial treasuries send it to the departments of health. And they say this is the money to finance laboratory services. The Department of Health keeps it. The hospitals in that province then send tests, blood, I mean for tests, to Delabrut. And then Delabrut must test, must do those tests and send the results back. And then went for an wait start invoicing. The laboratory will say, I tested blood from this and that hospital, and they start invoicing the provincial department. Then the provincial department must pay the National Health Laboratory Services. Once they are paid, they are able to pay staff to train the people we're mentioning, like lab technicians and even specialists in that field. They must even send money to the NICD, the National Institute of Communicable Disease. In other words, we have got, that is a world-class institute. If you remember, in the whole of SADC, it was the only one that could deal with Ebola, that could test for Ebola. There was no other institution. But for it to work, it waits for money, which comes from NHLS, which NHLS gets by being invoiced. You understand what I'm trying to say? So it means at the beginning of the year, the NHLS doesn't have a source of, it doesn't have a budget, but they sit and draw the budget and say, this year we'll pay this much to the CEO, we'll hire so many people, we'll train so many specialists, we'll buy so many chemicals, we'll buy so many cars, etc., and put it there and say, okay, for us to do that, we need 3.5 billion. But that 3.5 billion is not going to come from treasury to them. It's going to come via blood tests. It's going to come via blood tests, which means if the provinces don't send any blood to be tested, then this system will collapse. That's what it means, basically. Or if they send blood to be tested, they don't pay, then this system will collapse. Now, it can't be a good system. Now, sometimes, because they've got that money, 3.5 billion, they want to make it. If they realize it's June and they are not making it, what do they do? They just do more tests, which was the war between them and Gauteng case, KwaZulu-Natal. Do more tests that are not needed in order to build more. In other words, it's a perverse incentive. Yes, it's June now. We don't have, that money is not flowing in as it is. Let's build them. So province with complaining about being billed, even for tests that they never did, or tests that one professor even told me, because before the National Health Laboratory heavy system, every hospital has its own laboratory, and because sometimes hospitals have got poor record keeping, they will do a test today, lose the results, and take blood to repeat the same test tomorrow. In the old system, there will be a professor there who will tell them that no, we have just done this test yesterday, and here are the results, and they give you the results. Because some of the tests, you can't repeat them every day. Maybe blood sugar you can, but other tests, like if you have got cancer, why should it be repeated every day? The result is there. But in the present system, that professor was telling me, because I was used to the old coursework, no, there are tests here which are being repeated. When I stop them, the management say, hey, that's none of your business, we want the money, do the test. I said, no, but I've just done it. Here are the results. They are repeated. No, no, repeat and charge. So those were the perverse incentives. Now, when the province have got financial trouble, one of the institutions they don't pay is this one. Because they don't have a direct immediate gain. Maybe if they issued a tender, they would like to pay, but this is not a tender. So it's one of those who serve. It's like the what is the vaccine?
BioVac.
It's like BioVac. These are not tenders. These are state institutions. So they are the ones who suffer first. Now, where does this irregular expenditure came in? Because there was a time at the height of Ebola when provinces were not paying, and the laboratory was going down. So I asked the DG to write to you. I don't know whether it was you or Ian, was it them or Appropriation Committee? Yes, wrote to you and the Auditor General and Treasury to tell them we are now paying directly. We're not sending this money to provinces because we can't allow the laboratory to collapse. We want to send the money directly to the laboratory to save it, which we did, and it was 300 million. And the auditor general came back and said this is irregular expenditure because we did not follow the procedures of paying. We said, but we wrote letters. He said, no, you were supposed to wait for gazetting. Now, if I waited for gazetting, I can assure you here today how many people were going to die. So I then said, no, this cannot be allowed anymore. First thing we ask, Treasury to allow us. And former Minister of Finance read it in the budget speech last year, which I want to remind members about. We said NICD, the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, NIOH, National Occupational, NIOH is National Institute of Occupational Health, and the Cancer Registrar. All of them were being paid in this manner, waiting for blood to be tested, bill, then get money and pay. We said those institutions are very important. They must not be funded in that manner. Treasury must put up a budget and send it to them directly at the beginning of the year. And when we calculate that money, it was 700 million. And Treasury agreed. From last year, they are sending money directly to these three entities. So the three entities no longer depend on NHLS. Yeah. That was the first step, Chairperson. The second step is to do exactly what Honorable Volming is proposing, that we have got a central fund. Yeah. Now, that we cannot do without legislation. So I'm here to report that the legislation is ready. It has been, where is it now? Is it been? Yes. The legislation to do what you are asking, it's coming to you. We call it an NHLS bill. Where we'll do that now and completely break away with the past. So it is a process, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Because they were the only people who have to train a specialist via money levied for blood tests. You know what I mean? If you train a gynecologist, the money comes from Department of Higher Education. If you train a surgeon, but if you train a pathologist, the money to train them must come from blood tests. Which means as to the number of specialists they will train, it depends on how many blood tests were done. And we said, but it's also wrong. When you train a specialist, they must all be trained by money from the fiscus. So that process will come after the NHLSB. I actually forgot the salary bill. Every state entity, the salary bill come from Treasury. But here, the salary bill come from this blood test. So if provinces doesn't pay, it means you can't pay a professor there. You can't pay a specialist. I mean, you can imagine how abnormal it is. In fact, during this period, when the Auditor General blamed me, one of the things that scared me is that when the CEO told them, no, province didn't pay, there's a chance that we might not pay your salary. Many of highly paid specialists left. And I saw them leaving. I said, no, this cannot be left. That's why we have... Because one of the things in the Act is that the salaries for those people who work for the National Health Laboratory must be statutory, like your salary and mine, like any other doctor who works for the state. It's a statutory amount. So we are hoping we'll have completed that job when you have passed the bill. The 7.7 billion, I'm sure Mr. Ian van der Merwe can come to it. It's true. It's provinces. I don't want to upgrade my responsibility, but I want to raise to this committee. I want, because you said, what are the consequences? I just want to remind the committee that on these issues, my understanding is that you have got more powers than me on these issues. Yes. Because this issue of concurrent function, some of these things we saw them coming. It's not that we don't know them. Because even before the money, it starts with human beings. If they put the wrong human being there, some of them will sin. But I've got no power. I want to report to you that some of the people who are appointed, you know that this person is not going to make it, but it's appointed by a premier, not me. And you go and tell them, but they believe they've got powers, which and the minister has got no right to instruct them who to appoint. I've been told that many times. That no, this is not going to, it's not going to work very well, especially in financial management. If you check, financial management in health is very complex. It's not like in education. If you check all the departments that have ever been put under administration in provinces, it's health. It's not the other departments. You can go and check. In Free State, it was health that were put under administration. In Northwest, which we thought was doing very well, they were put under administration. In Gauteng, they were put under administration. In Limpopo, it was even Section 100. Which else? Northern Cape was put under administration. Eastern Cape. You can imagine out of 9, 3 were all under administration. It was only Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and now Mpumalanga was put under administration, sorry. It has always been Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal and Northern Cape that never went under administration for a period of 5 years. But very recently, Northern Cape went under administration. And the Premier took action, changed the old HOD, and put another one. I'm just reading a very bad message here. That Nehau has spent an admin blog in Kimberley Hospital because they want that HOD to go.
Nehau.
Yes, you see, I've just received it now. Because the MEC was phoning me as I was here. I said they must respond and ask him. He said, no, he wanted to report that Nehau has spent an admin blog in Kimberley because they say the HOD must go. The Premier told me that, look, I want to improve this department. I'm bringing a new HOD will be able to manage the finances. So these are some of the... That's why I'm saying you have got more power as parliamentarians when you go on your oversight on these issues. They are very important. The other, this procurement you are talking about that lead to regular expenditure. You talk to the MECs, they tell you straight that, yes, Minister, it's true, maybe you can help us. It is my executive council in the province which insisted on this. It's not me. It's not because they are not in charge of themselves. They are premiers there in executive councils. I have been trying to go around to try and plead with the executive council to show them. I've gone to Eastern Cape. Yesterday, I was in Gauteng to meet the executive council to tell them, please, when you do this, this is what will happen to the health system. I was trying to show them because I believe maybe they don't know. I'm hoping with those engagements, they'll start understanding. If you appoint a person like this, this is what happens to health. If you force procurement like that, this is what happens to health. Why was I doing that? Because even Harvard did a study. Harvard did a study in Africa, in the Far East, in the Caribbean, and North America to find out health systems that are not working very well. What do they have in common? What is their problem? They found number one, HR. Number two, procurement. Number three, supply chain. They said those are the things that are wrong in healthcare system around all those regions that I've mentioned, which they found common. And so this 7.7, it comes from there. The HR part of it, the procurement and all that, it leads to these irregular expenditures, which we believe you must interrogate as members of parliament. I will try my best, but I'm just telling you my limitation. I've got very serious limitation. Where we have got, we can take action, we do. Like I'm sure many of you might have seen 2 weeks ago, the story in Carte Blanche about the 90 million rand illegal tender that was issued in the Free State. Because it was to do with the Medical Research Council, the moment Carte Blanche told us that they are investigating this, we sent inspectors there, they came on a Friday. On Monday, we had already closed it, and the DG is taking action. Some people must be charged. But that is because we have got a direct interest, because it was to do with registration of medicines. But any other thing, you just watch at a distance and try to phone and try to, you know. Yes, but on this one, we said, no, MCC, move in. Send inspectors, go and chat somebody, this cannot be allowed. They were doing stem cell treatment. As you know, there's no stem cell treatment to treat arthritis at the cost of 30,000 rand per patient, paying to a private doctor. You know, so we had to stop it. I'm saying it because it was on Carte Blanche. It's not a secret, it's all public. And so these are some of the things that happen in provinces. Grossly illegal and unacceptable thing. Because when you do stem cell treatment, you even have to apply for an ethical, you know, to an ethics committee in your province. You have got to apply, I mean, in your university. You have got to apply to medical control council. But in the Free State, we have that, no, this thing is going on. People are being injected in their knees with stem cells and all that. It's grossly, grossly illegal. Now, when you have got power, you stop that. And I told them, because they were asking me, Minister, you're not playing your oversight role. I said, no, this one I'm taking action because it's directly my responsibility. But others are outside your purview, like issuing of tenders. We don't issue any tender in any province, as you know. They are issued by various provinces, their treasuries, and if the MEC tell you my premier has decided on this course of action, what do I do? And MECs don't listen to ministers, if you don't know. They listen to premiers, because ministers don't fire them or elect them.
But will premiers say, because I've always had a distinct that if then it's then the responsibility of the premier, sorry for that minister. What then becomes our role over premiers? When because whoever comes to the in front of the committee is the MEC, do we have a jurisdiction or a right to say to the premier of a particular province, can you please come with the MEC and the of health and
you have never tried it, but I suspect you can do it. Because it's the role of parliament to oversee the executive. Why do you call ministers and you can't call premiers? It has never been tried, but I'm just advising you that maybe it's high time that it must start. Because they say you are overseeing the executive. If you realize that this is wrong, why not? Of course, they'll start by fighting because it never happened, but I think it's high time that it must start happening. Because every person who is in government must be able to, yes. It's supposed to be the provincial legislatures, by the way. It's supposed to be provincial legislatures, but they don't usually do that.
And
I remember in Limpopo it was once done by Scopa, so successfully that a politician was fired, and people in Limpopo, that was very early on, that was during the time when there were Scorpions, they were saying no, we no longer keep our case to Scorpions, we go to Scopa now, these are the right people, because they went into, it was in the Department of Transport in Limpopo, they looked into the issue very deeply and came up with a verdict as a parliamentary committee. I still remember that. Investigating, every day they were sitting, the media was there. They were pushing questions. And they eventually reached and said, something went wrong. And a politician took a fall and people said, this is how we want government to work. Because then people are accounting to the elected people.
The select committee, what then becomes the role of the NCOP? In calling
you must
premiers.
Investigate it because
okay.
It does affect us. Yes. I mean, like for instance, there's a lot of litigation, as you know. Some of the litigation is because there's no equipment. Then I was telling as I'm going around, I'm telling premiers, if you don't give the department money to buy equipment, you are going to pay that money in the form of litigation anyway. Because when you ask MEC, why don't you buy this? No. I was not given a budget, the executive council refused. But this is a machine for babies. If babies don't get this, they are not, you know, this breathing, what do you call the yes, this unspent amount here, which was being unspent at the NHI pilot, was given to buy equipment. We said every single clinic must have this equipment. We even drew the list here and say this is the standard equipment for each and every clinic. And we gave them. Unfortunately, we have got to use the provincial tender mechanism because of the laws, again, as I'm saying. Then we wake up after 1 year, this equipment was not bought. And a baby is dying because they need that equipment. It was born prematurely, can't breathe very well. So that's why I'm saying it's high time that as our democracy matures, find out what are the limits of your powers as members of parliament. Because I do believe you have got that power to summon. I believe so. The issue of improving the situation in Northwest and Limpopo. Yes. And in Limpopo it was simple, sis. We didn't do any miracle under Section 100. We just appointed four people. And they moved from a disclaimer to unqualified. As to why they went back is a big puzzle. Maybe Tiny can tell because she was there as administrator. Why suddenly when we left Limpopo they went down? I told them I'm very disappointed. Because yes, you know, in my vocabulary there's something called wheelbarrow, you know. Yeah. You know, wheelbarrow, you pick it up, you push it. When you leave it, it just waits there until you pick it up again. And say, you can't act like wheelbarrows. We came here to help you. When we leave, we thought you'll move on your own. You must be like a skorokoro at least. You push it down the slope, somewhere stuck on its own because you gave it the push. Now, if you must keep on being there, picking, pushing, when you go away, yeah, because that's exactly what has happened. I told them that. And it's quite disappointing because it has even hit us very hard. I said it at MinMec. For the past 5 years, Northwest, Western Cape, National, get unqualified audit. Northwest, Western Cape, National, get unqualified audit. And I was saying, please, pick up yourself. Then this year, or last year, on this report, Eastern Cape, which is a miracle, they came on. And I was very excited. Gauteng came on. Then Limpopo moves out and Northwest moves out. You know? So I said we have taken 2 steps back forward. Then backwards. Why is that it happening that way? Because you're not in charge. Thank you, Test and Treat. Yes, thanks for saying it's working. And the issue of net specialization, yes, we will look into it because we believe it's very important, especially for, as you're saying, ICU, etc. But ICU trained nurses in South Africa, I'm afraid they never stay. They are in huge demand in Europe. Once you train a nurse in ICU in South Africa, it's not going to stay. Yeah.
But it's better to export them than not to have them.
Okay. The issue about National Health Laboratory test, let me go back and look, but it's a very difficult one. I don't appoint any exam board there. I appoint the board of NHLS. Yes. I was not even aware of this exam board. I don't know who appoints it. But usually when you are a politician, you get into issues of exam. They kick you even before you enter the door because they believe it's political interference. I once tried it when people were complaining. I'm sure you are aware there's a board exam for people who have passed medicine outside the country, who come here. It was even debate over the radio because that test, you'll never pass it. Until you try 3 times. It's very rare to pass it at the first try. So I interfered. I intervened. And over the radio, they were attacking me to say this thing is not going to make doctors come and all that. Because there was a doctor who failed from Eastern Europe who failed 3 times. And when you fail 3 times, it's over. You'll never enter. So she went to the radio to complain. During the radio interview, the professor, one of them who was in this examination board, he phoned in and said, I'm a member of this exam. This is a very fair exam, we can assure you. We stand by it, minister, don't interfere. Every person who wants to, must be a doctor must pass this exam. If they can't pass it, then they must forget about medicine. That's what he said. And he said, don't interfere politically. This is a very fair test. So I'm not sure whether on this one, I'll be told the same thing, but I'll go ahead and look. But all I'm saying is on these issues of who passes, who fails, we don't usually interfere. If we're interfering, there would have been a big fight with medical schools because there are students there who get excluded and who fail and all that, who are doing medicine and you know. And we believe it's a purview of universities, not ours. The Auditor General's recommendation province, I'll leave it to the CFO because they've got a CFO forum. Specifically to try and solve. We went to that extent. Form a CFO forum, help these provinces. We help them all the time. We pick them up, but some of them just stop on the way like wheelbarrow thing and go back after we have helped. The issue of skills, to deal with neonatal mortality, Honorable Maisela. Yes, these are the skills we're talking about. We train, we give nurses a special skill on how to ventilate the baby and all that. When they are good, they move them to another section. Because not many, all the nurses will come up with this skill. It's a special skill. So this is the issue we look at. Condoms. Yes, it is true, Honorable Maisela. It was it in 2013? I felt very hard done by. The Human Science Research Council releases research that shows that condom use has declined in the country. And the report was released at the time when condom distribution was doubled. We have doubled the number of condoms. That time from 250 to 500 million. I'm sure you see here we are at 800 million. But condom use was declining. It worried us. So we investigated through peer groups. That's when what Deputy President did in Parliament happened. When he was telling you there in Parliament. The young people told us that these condoms are not user-friendly, you know, the things he said there. I don't want to repeat them here because I remember. Yes, but that type of marketing helped us because people are talking about meds now. It was called ambush marketing. And you know why I like it? Your kids are asking you, it might be embarrassing, but I launched that project with him on the 24th of June, this new condom, in Peter Maritzburg. The media was there, but they never got interested. When we launched it and showed it, there were kids there who were carrying the various flavors and, you know, introducing them. We're trying to make it exciting, but it was never reported. But when he did it to members of parliament, it was all over. And so I said, Deputy President, your ambush marketing helped us. Because everybody is asking, what is this max? You know? What is this max? Except that former speaker is very angry with me. Former speaker, Max Isulu, said, why do you hate me so much? How can you make a condom and name it max? What is this? And he said, my kids are asking me everything. So I said, it was not me. We had a competition, honorable members. After we asked these kids, they are the ones who came with these ideas about the flame. It's not us. We call them peer. I don't know this organization that was conducting it in peer groups of youth, meeting them in groups. And we said, you must name it. They came with this name, Max. It doesn't mean Max. It's maximum. The maximum protection, maximum pleasure, as it was said, maximum strength, and that's what the kids are interested in. But we believe condom use since that time is that excitement, because they were saying the smell of latex on the choice condom was the one which was letting them off. Yeah, now we believe things will change. But the other thing, as you know, we are not only issues, it's not only an issue of condoms that my seller. We also, at the same day, when we're launching this condom, launched that P project to focus on girls between the age of 15 and young women up to age of 24. Because when you say the infection is going up, it's going up in this age group, not in all age groups. 15 to 24 years old, in 14 African countries, including ours, the rate of infection is 5,000 new infections per week, not per month. And unfortunately, half of them are happening here. So we launched this project, which will cost 3 billion rand. We got money from German Development Bank, Global Fund, and our own government. It's called Whole Government, Whole Society Program, where we are targeting on these young girls to do five things. Reduce the rate of infection. 2, reduce the rate of teenage pregnancy. 3, reduce the rate of gender-based violence. 4, keep these girls in school for as long as possible, at least up to matric. 5, link them to skills and business opportunities if possible, in order to de-link them. You know, they must no longer be dependent on men who impregnate, and these people, which I don't like using that term, but is used all over, which you call blessers. Can we find a way that they no longer depend on them? by giving them skills. That's why we launched this program. And we have chosen 22 districts in the country that are the highest burden. Not district, sorry. Sub-district, that means municipality. We said in these 22 municipalities, that's where the problem is. Let's go there. And when we arrive in the municipality, we don't just do it at random. We say the kids within this age group are at school or at university or in a college. Then we take the list of schools. We look at the school with the highest number of teenage pregnancy. That is the best school to start. And we go, and then we are going to start checking these kids one by one. That means we are going to screen them and see if we can profile them. We need a profile here. Mm-hmm. We believe going to a school and say, yes, there's a lot of teenage pregnancy, take condoms, it's no longer helping us. We are going to profile them one by one. And after profiling, you will then say, but this girl is not yet pregnant, but within the next year or so, she will be, because of the profile she gives you. Mm-hmm. What will that be? It might be that you discover that she's heading a child-headed family, and she's the head, and she's still in matric. The chances are very high. She's about to fall pregnant. So can you link her to some contraceptive device and help her? Others, you can see that this one is not yet HIV positive, but it's just a matter of time. Can we offer her PrEP? Because there is this question of the World Organization has passed this PrEP to VADA. Can we give it to every girl? No, we'll give it to specific ones where we say, look, we've profiled you, you are HIV negative, but it's just a matter of time. Can we put you on pre-exposure prophylaxis just to make sure that you don't get HIV and explain what it is? And also explain pre-exposure prophylaxis. This girl has not yet been raped, but from her profile, you know, not only rape, just sexual assault by relatives from the conditions here. So this is how we are going to carry this. But when we finish for the first time in this project, we are going to go for Maine now. In that municipality, after talking to these young girls, how many men know their status? How many have been circumcised? How many have tested positive and are put on treatment? Because if you put as many men on treatment and they become virally suppressed, they will continue doing what they are doing because it's behavioral, but at least they won't transmit the virus. That's also our target. So we'll target these men through churches, through yourself in your constituency office. Come and help us in this project. Yes, this is going to be the biggest project in the history of fighting HIV/AIDS in the country. And we are planning with anxiety because we don't know whether we'll get enough person power to screen all these young girls and be able to put them appropriately. But this is the one we're doing. So it's not just issuing the max condom only. It's a broad range of things. Pneumonia. Yes. Dr. Maisela, the reason that pneumonia became prevalent in South Africa is obvious. HIV and AIDS. As you know, HIV and AIDS itself doesn't kill, but it exposed people of pneumonia and all that. And remember, only 10 years ago, 70,000 babies were born HIV positive in South Africa. And within 6 months, many of them were gone. Today, because of the success of the PMTCT, the figure is down to less than 6,000. But South Africa also did something extraordinary. We introduced two new vaccines, pneumococcal and rotavirus vaccines. According to the statistics from NICD, admissions from pneumonia dropped by a whooping 70%. So the few that you see them dying are the ones who go to hospital, but 70% of them who are going to hospital are no longer going because of this vaccine. Same as rotavirus. So those vaccines are, and we are the first country on the continent to give these vaccines. I just want you to record that, Chairperson, because sometimes when things are tough in health, people believe nothing is happening. It could have been worse with pneumonia if we didn't introduce those vaccines. They are very expensive vaccines, I must tell you, but we are giving them and they've helped. They've helped a lot. Severe acute malnutrition. I want also to, yes, I accept. During this era and time, children should not be dying of malnutrition. That's why it's in the Sustainable Development Goals. But the measure here we're giving you is not about children dying of malnutrition. It says severe acute malnutrition case fatality rate. Please understand it. It means what are the number of children who end up in hospital with malnutrition? Out of that number, how many die? Now, we found that the case fatality rate was very high, and we wanted to know why. We discovered that our hospitals were not following the World Health Organization standard treatment protocols for malnutrition. Now, they are, for instance, that standard treatment protocol says kids with severe malnutrition must be fed every 2 hours? Every 3 hours or so. Yes, regular intervals. When we went to our hospitals, they tell you, no, the clinic closes at 8 o'clock in the evening until the following day. So this child is not going to survive. We said, no, you can't do that for children with malnutrition. So we changed all those, and we believe this case fatality rate is going to improve. The other is bringing them early. That's where WOPO's team come in. If we had WOPO's team in all the municipalities, then we'll, or in all the families, then they'll pick up these children with malnutrition and bring them to hospital early. So the case fatality rate is how many of them die because they've got malnutrition, because they did not come early, or when they come to hospital, wrong procedures are being followed. So we have corrected that. We are hoping in the next reporting we'll start seeing the case fatality rate going down. Screening of physical barriers to learning, that it's not progressing very well. Honorable Maisela, it's true. This is just the beginning. We're just studying. There are 12 million kids at school in South Africa every day. We decided when we started to start with those who are in quintile 1 and 2 schools, the poorest. So you're not going to find this everywhere. It's only in quintile 1 and 2 schools. And we have done only 800,000. So if you consider that there are 12 million kids, 800,000 looks like a drop in the ocean. But we have just started. And if you go to a quintile 3 school, you won't find it, or, you know. So it was quintile 1 and 2 schools where we were doing it. And these kids have been linked to audiologists, optometrists, and speech therapists. There's going to be a contract given to them to help them. Then we'll start expanding it. So it is just really the beginning. But we believe it's going to be the mainstay of one of the mainstays of the re-engineering of primary health care. The HPV vaccine, Amban will tell us whether, I don't think, no vaccine is produced in South Africa anyway. There's no vaccine which we produce on our own, at least not on the African continent. We are only debating now through BRICS and all that. And people believe South Africa, which must become the first African country to manufacture its own vaccine. Even BioVac here, they reconstitute vaccines they don't manufacture from the beginning. And so it's still part of development. The issue of chemicals for testing salt, I'll leave it to the COO. She's the one who mentioned it. And be able to explain, I don't have all the true facts. Underspending of funds to refurbish hospital. I'm sure you are aware it has been living with us, this issue. Where we do the job on our own, we do very well. Where you go to public works, as they do in the province, there's always trouble. Very big trouble. I'm just being told that part of this irregular expenditure comes from that. Implementing agents, especially he's talking about IDT and public works. Part of this 7.7 billion is because of that. And when you talk to many MECs that when you do it on your own is better, they tell you, my province have decided that I must take the money to IDT. And then problems start. I still remember in Limpopo, in the books, they had spent 100 million rand to build clinics. But when the MPs went to the ground, they don't find a single clinic. Yeah. And they said, what's going on? They say we have spent 100 million rand because they gave it to IDT. So it's out. It's spent. But the IDT has not even built a single clinic. Those are some of the problems that we are experiencing. in this system, you know. The issue of pension monies that were not paid to mine workers, you are right, Honorable my fellows. Part of it's our past history. This mine worker, Scott TB, from Lesotho, just disappeared, and they keep quiet. So because now we are tracing them, we'll help them. These monies have got nothing to do with CCOD. Pension monies kept by various pension agencies. But because the mine worker has disappeared because they've got TB, in fact, according to the mapping that was shown yesterday, this new track and what, they were telling us that they believe the whole of Lesotho, because they were even able to trace them to the cities to see which city has got more people who, which town or village, more mine workers who are working in South Africa. And they said they believe the level of TB there is overwhelming. That's why we're going to get all these ministers to come together. So that we from SADC, so that we show them the ward-based primary health care teams. Yes, it's still the beginning. You won't find them in every ward, Honourable Maisela, because we have just started. But number two, we don't think it's fair for us to put these teams in each and every ward in South Africa, even though in our document say so. Some wards are richer than others. You don't need a primary health care team. If you send the primary health care team to a ward in Sandton, they're not even going to listen to that person in the first place. They don't even need them because they can take care of their own health needs. So we'll send them only to wards that need them the most. In fact, the National Development Plan says we must have 700,000 of them by 2030, 700 primary health care teams, and we're working towards that. Mine being a private territory, I wanted to know, Honorable Maisela, because I thought you had information, which mine is that, because not with TB, it can't be allowed, but we can't allow any place to be called a private territory if we're going to check TB. I'm sure you are aware that there is even a court case we've won, where somebody with MDR-TB was refusing treatment. We had to go to court and tell the judge that, no, this person is going to kill if he's not treated. And we got that order that the person must be treated. It no longer has to do with individual rights. It has to do with rights of the whole population. But the second thing, we don't want to get into the mine and do screening. We don't, Honorable Maisel. We want the mines themselves to screen. These are their employees that take that responsibility. So all we did was to hire 9 inspectors in the Department of Health. And I think we hired them, was it last year or 2014? It's a new phenomenon. I think it's 2014. We hired 9 inspectors. Each one of them is given certain number of mines. Go in there and check and get proof that mine workers are being screened for TB and bring the report back. And I can report to you today that the inspectors came back. According to the report they give, 90% of the mines are screening. And we'll keep on pushing them. Because in the past, they make it a responsibility of government. Then we are saying, but you are mining the gold and infecting people with TB and expect the state to come in. No. You must treat them on your own. We will make sure that we inspect you to make sure that you are screening and treating. So at the moment, that's what's happening. That's why I didn't understand this issue of somebody saying it's private territory, because it's only the inspector who gets in there, not the screening team who will never screen there. We were stupidly trying to do that in the past, but we said no. And mining bosses have agreed. They are very cooperative, I must say, on this one. Because part of the reason you saw the class act, the class action where the judges ruled that they could go and sue. Because I told them, 50% of those people who are going to undertake that last action, they are going to do it for TB. So I said, mine, bosses, is in your interest, not mine actually, to screen and treat for TB, because if you don't, you are going to pay that money as a last action. And I think they understand it. They understand it, and that's why they won't stop this screening. I suspect even if we don't send inspectors, they will still screen, because otherwise they will be sued, you know. Honorable Khosa, some MECs, when I reprimanded them for not getting good audits, they said, yeah, you, for the past 5 years we have been stagnant at unqualified audit, you are not moving to a clean audit. Now, I might say something that is controversial. Maybe I must be careful, Chairperson. We'll never get a clean audit in health. We'll end at unqualified, I think, until certain things changes. The longest serving HOD, I'm saying so because the longest serving HOD who just retired in 2014, who served for 19 years, the HOD here in the Western Cape, Professor, yes, Housen, who started in the Free State and came here, is a master of this audit because he has been in one job for 19 years. There's no other, nationally or in any province, who stayed for 19 years. And he has never gone beyond unqualified. Why? Because we are not audited for money only in health. If we are for money, we'll show you every cent. We'll show you every cent. We're not, there are very few thugs in health because we fight them. We fight them. We make sure that everything is clean. So it's money. The problem is we are not audited for money. We are audited even for performance. For instance, just to give you an example, I'm sure they're correct. When you say you have immunized 1,000 babies, they say, can we see the road to health chart to check if indeed they are immunized? But the mothers take this chart home. When you say you have given ARVs to 1 million people, they say, can you give us a proof that this 1 million got their ARVs and they are taking them? Can we have a proof? Did they just collect them? Are they swallowing them? It's like saying we gave 800 million condoms. Can you give proof that they are being used? These are some of the things which we are debating with the OGR. Why are you giving us this type of audit? Now, recently, they are about to release an audit on drug stockouts, not on money and all that. And they check many things to have a pharmacist. And I even told them that you are mad now, the lady who was doing this audit. Yes, because I've worked in health for, I've been a doctor for 3 years. In many rural hospitals, you'll never find a qualified pharmacist, but they train somebody. But if they go there and find a person with no degree in pharmacy, it's a finding in the audit. It's a finding in the audit that, no, you don't have a pharmacist here. You don't, you know. So some of these things we believe are just... That's why I was telling you this morning that there was a clash between HODs and the Office of Health Compliance, where they wanted to be inspected on the temperature in the pharmacy and say it must be 22 degrees, and the HOD is saying, at least give us a range. Because if you say it's 22, we're all going to fail. Because maybe at the time the inspectors come, it's 22.1. It has been 22 all the time because temperatures, you know, and then they fail you and go away. So some of the people don't understand health, and when we tell them, they get angry because they've got power. We tell a lady, the auditor general sent you to come and audit us. You don't understand how health works. This is not how the health system works. Anywhere in the world, you are asking impossible things. They won't happen, these things that you are asking us. That's why we have got this feeling that getting a clean audit in health is a mammoth of a task. I'm sure they can give you examples here. Where do I go and during the auditor general's time rush to all the families and ask for the ladies to bring back the immunization card or the road to health card? They say, no, we have to see it. Mothers take it home. Mothers take it home. Then they said, no, then we don't have any proof that these kids were immunized. These are some of the biggest problems that, yeah. Ideal clinic, where are they situated and what is it? Chairperson, let me tell you this idea, how it came. When we're developing NHI, the first thing we said was that primary health care is going to be the heartbeat, meaning prevention of disease and promotion of health. But also that when you start treatment, you go to the lowest level, not to the highest, which is what was happening in the past. Now, we then agree, Chairperson, all of you in the areas where you come from, you will attest to us, clinics in South Africa have been reduced to just places where you go and collect pills and bag, because our healthcare system is very curative. It's very hospice-centric, if I have to put it that way. Clinics were ignored over a long time. We're starting from the beginning to rebuild them. Infrastructure, staffing, people are ignoring clinics. When people are in Soweto, they are sick, they just rush to Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital immediately. Now, we are trying to win them away from that. But if you send them to clinics in the manner in which they are, they'll come and fight us. So we said, let's improve the clinics. What should the clinic look like? Even for me on medical aid, to go there and get help when I come out and say, oh yes, I can go to this clinic again. What should it look like? We then developed that in terms of administration, infrastructure, staffing, clinic committees, that means governance. We actually produced a booklet, maybe we must give you. Yes. We then defined the ideal clinic. We then said, let's learn how this method works. We chose 10 clinics in South Africa. One of them, which you mentioned, is Mutubazi. Mutubazi clinics looks like that. It was one of the first clinics where we learned what an ideal clinic is. For instance, if you go there, it won't run out of electricity. If anything happens to the Tshwane electricity, municipal electricity, they've got a big generator there to kickstart. Generators were never in clinics before. Even hospitals were struggling to get them. But all the ideal clinics must have. And you can't steal it because it's huge. It's huge and it's deeply rooted in the ground. They can't easily run out of water at least for a week because we have given each one of them a 10,000 liter drum that if any happens to the municipal water, at least for 5 days, this one must survive, you know. So I'm just giving you an example of the things that are in the ideal clinic. So we, after those 10, we then said, let's expand. Now, we gave the measures of what an ideal clinic to the Office of Health Standard Compliance to go and inspect. When they went for the first time, only one clinic qualified. Today, we have got 322 clinics. Remember, we've got 3,500. This is only 10%. But it's a start. It shows that if we continue, it's only 10%, but I think having the increase now, the 322, yes, the number has increased. We are increasing them. And some are saying, no, we have got very few clinics that are ideal. It's because the standard is very high. We put it very high so that we work towards that high standard. If we put it lower, all the clinics will pass, but you won't be satisfied with them. So we have to put the standard very high and say, biggie, Magmere, you do 300, which is 10%, you add another 10%, in 5 years' time, half of the clinics will be ideal. Sorry? 500. Yes, you see, there are 500. They can give you a list. That Mutubazi is one of them. And in OR Tambo, I can give you, because you also asked about this infrastructure. In OR Tambo, I can give you 8 clinics that we are about to complete. We even have the dates on which we are going to complete them and open them. All of them were dilapidated clinics, and we discovered that you can't even renovate them. They are beyond repair. You need to build from the beginning. Now, we said when we build them, we're not going to build an ordinary clinic. We're going to build an ideal clinic because we have got an architectural plan also of what an ideal clinic is, which means any new clinic we build must meet that standard. Any old one, when we renovate, it must also meet the ideal clinic standard. What is it? If you go to those clinics in the Eastern Cape, I'm mentioning it because it's OR Tambo and Vembe, where we found clinics that are beyond repair. What do you find? We said when you build it, make sure that TB is catered for. Make sure that HIV/AIDS is catered for. Make sure that if they are going to deliver babies, we have got houses for nurses who must sleep here. You know, make sure that it's adolescent friendly. When adolescents want condom, they are not going to be returned and be chased away. There must be a place where they get counseling. All those you'll find in ideal clinics. And we can give you the names in the Eastern Cape. You'll go and see them. One of them, Lusikisiki, which was the worst, even ran in a tent. We are opening it in March next year. And it's a state of the art. Something that you'll see is out of this world. In March, we'll open it officially. So it's not that we don't have work on the ground. We have got it. The problem is that we have just started this new approach to health of our clinic. And it's new, very, very new. The issue of developing HIV prevention, yes, we started long ago. I'm sure they used the wrong word, as if we're just starting again. We change our method all the time. The other thing I'll report to you, the engineering services have just finished. All the 900 structures in the 10 pilot projects have just finished checking them, what needs to be done and how much. In other words, it's no longer theory, they have costed it. If you have got 2 million rand, this is what you'll improve in this clinic, this is what it looks like. We have just finished it for 900. What is left is to go, I don't know, Tiny, because I gave you that homework 2 days ago, about issue of infrastructure that you must unblock. I don't know, can I give you 2 minutes just to tell us? In other words, we have got a plan now that this clinic and the name, it needs this, it needs that. All that is left is to put somebody on. Yes.
Minister, we have unblocked the blockages of the outstanding project award. So the departmental feedback has concluded its job. The infrastructure unit has concluded its job. So we are at the approval stage.
Meaning what? Approving that they must go and
the award, yes.
Award meaning giving a contract.
Yes, sir.
So when members go out,
they will find a contractor on site.
In 900 projects.
I'm not sure about the number, Dr. Carter.
But they'll start finding them in other ways. Yes. So we'll give you the list. Because Ndatima is like, if you just move around searching these things out of 3,500 when you are still studying, you may not find them. So we must give you and say, here you'll find it. Shortage of staff. That's why there is Wisen, Chairperson. Now, I'm surprised when a doctor told you that in Wisen, we just go in clinical. I don't know where he gets that from. Honestly, Wisen is a mathematical formula worked by the World Organization. It's everything. It's staffing at all levels, admin and all that. And I don't know why the doctor says so, because we have never implemented Wisen in the country. What we have done, we've just finished calculating it for every clinic in the country. At primary health care, we're finished, meaning if you give me the name of the clinic, I'll be able to open Wisen to tell you it has got so many nurses, it needs this, or it has got more than enough, it has got so many physiotherapists, or it needs one. I can show you that. One of the things it revealed, which shocked us, was that we don't actually have a shortage of nurses. We've got a shortage of admin staff. That's what Wisen showed us. Admin staff and cleaners. And they said the shortage of nurses is self-induced in the country. Every time you short a particular occupation, you put a nurse. That's how South Africa has been run, and we want to correct it. If you have got no data capture, you put a nurse. In a rural clinic where there's no pharmacist, the nurse become a pharmacist.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's how nurses work, unfortunately, in the country. Where you have got no social worker, the nurse become a social worker. Where you have got no cleaner, she must do the cleaning. That was discovered by Wisen, that if we fill up all the other occupations that are needed, we'll free our nurses. There's other findings. I've been knowing it from 2009. They've proved it. We have got commanders, but not the soldiers in South Africa, in public hospitals.
Mm.
We have got no more professional nurses, what you call nursing sisters, than the enrolled nurses who do the real work. Now, yes, we have got more commanders than the troops because of that new curriculum introduced in 1987, which was trying to reverse. The private sector, if you go to the private hospitals, They've got very few professional nurses, but they've got more enrolled nurses. If you go to a private, especially during the night, the whole floor, you'll find only one sister with maroon epaulets. The others are all white. These are the soldiers. In the public sector, it's the other way, and it gives us trouble. So we are going to try and change that in YSN. We are going to give it to Treasury, sit with them and budget. In the tertiary hospitals, we are still working on YSN. It's very complex. If you have to say a hospital like here, like Groteskier, how many nurses does it need? How many doctors at this level? It's very complex. We don't know how long it will take us. But at the moment, we're finished for the clinics. Mental health. Yes, chairperson say we must come and screen all of you. We'll be very glad to come and screen all of you here. And it's one of the things that needs to be done. But people don't understand. When we went to the Mental Health Summit, they said the prevalence of mental health in South Africa is, did they say 35% or 30? People were saying, whoa. What they mean is this. It's a lifelong prevalence, and we want people, because this story was in the Sunday Times, they distorted so much. They don't mean all of us are mentally ill, 30% of us. What they mean is at one stage or the other, if you are a South African, 30% of us at one stage or the other will have issues with mental health. It might be that your wife or husband or child has just passed on during that period. You know, you have got depression, you can't sleep very well. That's a mental problem, but it's passing. So they are saying 30% of the population at one stage or the other will experience that and they need help. Now, in our culture, we believe you can't have a psychologist or a psychiatrist because it's a stigma. Other nations know that it's normal. You have got to have a psychiatrist, you go to a psychologist at one stage or the other. Which one of us has never been depressed here? You won't be normal if you have ever been. I hear people boasting about that, that they've not been depressed or they can't be stressed. You can't. Yes, you have to go through it at one stage or other, all of us. That's what they are talking about. You know. And then for the facilities, we've just discussed with MECs. We have chosen a certain number of facilities in which we want to change beds, I mean to add beds for psychiatric patients. We're even forced by the Department of Justice, Chairperson, because we have got other pressures here. I'm sure you have noticed it. Every lawyer whose client has killed doesn't go to jail. They say mental test. Even when you know this thing is a killer, man, they say, no, maybe ID, right? Yeah? Yes, and then they send them there for 30 days. Observation. Even Oscar, you saw they do that. He just killed that man. He's not mad, as far as I'm concerned. But he had to go to our facilities and for 30 days. So we're discussing this with justice that is overburdening us. It's heavy on us. Because we discovered that the magistrate and judges don't even understand. Because psychiatrists say sometimes it takes us 5 days to make a conclusion about this person. But the judge's ruling was 30 days. So they have to keep that person for 30 days there, keeping a bed that could be used. So we are discussing with the Department of Justice how to change all those things. But this strategy, if you even want to take it with the, I don't know who, this strategy that every lawyer defends is madness. Even when these people have just killed, they are criminals. They are criminals all over the world. And to say all criminals are mentally ill when they have just a criminal mind, it's really causing us problems, you know? Yeah, the impact of fees must fall. If medical students don't write exams this year, it's going to be the first time in the history of South Africa that we start a year without new doctors. I don't remember it as far back as I can remember, especially because provinces, as you know, to make sure that they get graduates, every province sponsors medical students. Long before NEFSAS and all that, provinces sponsor medical students and sign contracts with them. Each province knows that I'm expecting so many doctors. Because it's not by chance. It's not like engineering or what, or commerce where we don't know who's going to come in. Provinces know that I sponsored, so many doctors, so many are doing final year. They are going to come. Even before the exam, they've already allocated to hospital, hoping that they are going to pass. So if they don't come, it's going to hit us very hard. Next year, we might withstand it because they are interns. Remember, interns, we send them to hospitals where they are already senior doctors to teach them. The disaster will come in 2018 because it's community health. Those who should have done internship next year and go into community health the following year, because community health, we specifically, not community health, community service, COMSERV, we specifically send them to hospitals where no doctor wants to go, because doctors don't like to go to rural hospitals. That's where we send COMSERV. Any hospital with no doctor, we say go there. We know they like choosing the cities, and we tell them for COMSERV, there's no hospital in Gauteng which is open to COMSERV. We closed all of them. There's no hospital in the center of Cape Town which is open to COMSERV. Go to Engqoba, go to, you know, we send them all around. Now, that is how it's going to hit us if we can't get them. And we'll see how we are going to deal with it. Yeah. Tobacco control. They ran away. There are two ladies here. I don't know why. Yes. From the teaser, one of them has just been selected. And they've got this trick. I've seen it. This tobacco industry. They've got the trick of sending ladies to me. I don't know what they think. No. Yes. No. I'm not joking. Because they believe we'll be very sympathetic. Yes. One of the ladies, I told, a young girl, I can see you, very nice person, I'm not going to fight you, but you are working for a wrong company, you're not going to convince me. Because they sent innocent young girls who have just started work to plead with me. Maybe they act innocent. When I saw this young girl introducing herself, I said, there it starts. Now the chairperson was very evil or very heavy on her, because she thought she's going to monitor me. Now the chairperson said, you must control tobacco. That's why she ran away, because she was going to lobby you people. They are lobbying you. Let me tell what's happening around the world. Around the world, all these people who are producing food, sugar, tobacco, alcohol, etc., the tobacco ones have got no place in many countries now. Now what they've done, they've realized that the world economy is down. Unemployment, especially among the youth, is high. That is the strategy they use. Anything you want to regulate, the first thing they bring, unemployment, economy, unemployment. Even the sugar industry is doing that now. Unemployment, economy. Now, because unemployment is high, even the tobacco industry, they want to reverse the laws we've already passed, for your information. They're entering through unemployment, economy. And I keep on asking them, do you want to create these jobs for corpses? Because if people are dying, they won't be able to create this. So we are fighting, chairperson, and I'm not going to stop fighting. Because we are bringing to you four new amendments to the Tobacco Control Amendment Act. We are going to give you four new amendments very soon. They are ready. One, we want to abolish the 25% space in public places. You are aware that in public places, restaurant, they must choose a place where you must smoke, right? Even in hospitals, which is madness. How can we choose a space? But maybe I'm using a wrong word. It was negotiation. Now we are at the situation where we can no longer negotiate. We'll remove it. In restaurants, in hospitals, everywhere, no more 25% smoke. It must be gone. And we want you to pass that amendment. Number two, if you go to the airport, you'll see it, and some of you have complained to me. They just stand outside and start smoking. Yeah. We want to extend that distance to about 50 meters or so, so that you feel you get fresh air even when you go out and go to your car. Yes, it's coming. Number three, we have banned adverts on radio, TV, everywhere. But when you get into any supermarket, they are there, the cigarettes are in glass, you know, cages and all that. That law is going to say, go and lock the cigarette somewhere. Only the smoker who wants it, you'll go and unlock and take it out. In a locker that which nobody can see. That's the third one. The fourth one, cigarettes are not supposed to be sold for children under the age of 18. But then you have got vending machines all over. That vending machine doesn't know the age. So we are going to ban all the vending machines. They must be removed. Those are the things we are coming with. Then the other one, which is still in the early stages, is the branding, which has been done in England, in Ireland, in Australia, that all cigarettes must be in one ugly pack. We are also about to bring that law to you. So we're not stopping on this one. And I was asking whether it's lung cancer. The Medical Research Council is going to call a press conference to announce it. They are very excited that the incidence of cancer, and I thought it was lung, I didn't know that esophagus, has dropped, and chronic respiratory disease. The incidence have dropped because of the laws we have passed. So don't think when you pass strict laws here, there are no gains. There are very serious gains to the public and economy. They are going to show you in figures what the lung cancer rate was before and what it is in the past 15 years. It takes time, but you eventually win. Like this HPV vaccine. We are spending money now, we are injecting kids, we are bringing here to you, you won't see any results. Believe me, in 20 years' time, you'll see the drop of cervical cancer. And people then will be proud of it. But you won't be there, fortunately, unfortunately. Yes.
Okay,
I mean, yeah. Okay. About 20 years. No, that's the time a 9-year-old girl will be. Maybe 15. That's the time a 9-year-old girl now who is getting an HPV will be likely to get cervical cancer. Then you'll see it has completely dropped. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the minister has covered all the other except the one or two from the finance side.
Thanks, Chair. I'll be brief. The issue of assisting provinces, we're actively assisting provinces with the audit outcomes. We've got the CFO forum, as Minister said. We've also looked at the Gauteng success story, and they've been using Saika quite successfully. We finalized the MOU, and provinces will be able to make use of that MOU. Saika is the South African Institute for Chartered Accountants. So we'd like to
cover, Chairperson, when a province works with the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, the audit improves, because those people are qualified accountants. They send people from their members to come and help, and we see audits improving. That's what it's true. Is it a tender or they just help?
No, they help us, but they actually do it at a quite reduced cost. So it's not young CAs, let me say that. It's mature CAs, guys who've got experience and so on. And most of them, can I say, they've already made their money, if you like. For them, it's not an issue of driving, you know, looking for.
Meaning they're already rich.
Yeah, they and it's even so, Chair, that some of them are even prepared to relocate, like, for 4 or 5 months to Kimberley, you know, to assist there. Yeah. So it's actually a very nice project. Yeah, so we'll see how it goes on. But just to say that the international, we intend assisting 3 provinces with financing. Being Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, and Free State on this project. The other issue that we're trying to also influence a little bit more this financial year is that when provinces deal with the AG, we'd like to have a presence, you know, together with departments. Sometimes when you deal with the AG, you have to have some pushback and not accept everything. Irregular expenditure is one example, for instance. In our case, we do negotiate and we do engage the AG on certain principles, so when it becomes technical, we can engage them. Some provinces don't have that technical ability, and then obviously they accept what the AG tells them, and the irregular expenditure also increases.
Chairperson, there's something about the AG, anyway, I'm just saying it because you'll never win. That's a powerful office. For instance, when they audit us, they will tell you are using a lot of consultants, and, you know, but they send people from other companies to audit us, and many of them, you find that they understand nothing about your sector. They just put your clubs and sit here. That's what he's talking about, that you have got to fight back and show them. Yeah. Like I told you about this young lady I thought about who was auditing us on pharmacies. I said, hey, it's clear you have never been to a rural area. You, yes, to her, it's non-compliance. But all rural areas have got those problems. So sometimes when you deal with the Auditor General, you need to be able to push back and people believe you are being nasty. Because they don't do the audit themselves. They outsource it and give a company. When you arrive there, you may find that is a company that is hearing the word health for the first time.
Yeah, so I think that's an important matter. But what we also see is, Chair, is that in provinces where the CFO and HOD has been consistently there, that pushback gets done quite more. And Eastern Cape is a good example.
I'm sure, Chairperson, that's what I've said.
Yeah.
When I said you go to the Premier, it's true. I even told the Premier there. The reason that Eastern Cape is becoming what it is because at least
3 years.
For the past 3 years, is it 2 years or
three
years? They've been having consistent people. Four people. HR, HOD, CFO, even the MEC consistent. Because the other years they were just kicking. Next, you can go to education, they've had as many HODs as the number of years in a democracy. You'll never get the clean audit because audit, as Ian is saying, you've got to get used to them and know the corner. You know, otherwise, if you keep on changing people, and I said, Premier, I don't want to interfere with you. Eastern Cape is now on the right course. Keep this team together and you'll see good results. Now, in Limpopo, for instance, that's another reason. The attrition rate there, you know, it's, there's no way that they'll stabilize and ever get the clean audit. And these are some of the things members of parliament must speak.
So just on the point, the root causes that Aisha mentioned, I think, is vacancies, which we just discussed now, the churn rate of CFOs and HODs. The second one was the issue of consequence management, if I recall. So if there's a regular expenditure, somebody has to be held accountable for it, you know, in terms of the PF, and I think this is what the AG is also recommending. And then just lastly, on the issue of clean audits, Minister is right that if you look at your total audit, it will be difficult to get a clean audit. But as far as financials, we've come quite close the last two financial years. This financial year, we were basically there. It's just that there's under expenditure of the HPV vaccines, and the claims from provinces made it an emphasis of matter. And that was the only point that we had on the finances. But it will definitely keep on going for the clean audits. Just one point, that provinces, I think, that are getting unqualified reports now, it's one thing to get an unqualified report, but to maintain it is definitely, definitely much more difficult, actually, going forward. Okay.
No, okay. Thank you, Chair. Just a small matter, but it's critical. The Chair raised an issue about the 43 versus 44. That the Office of Health Standards says we transferred 44 and our books say 43. We will follow up with them, Chair, because they rely on our figures and that is our audited figure. The 43 is the audited figure. We still pay their salaries from our personal, so they need to use the figures that we have. Thank you, ma'am.
I think we have everything that has been asked has been clarified in terms of the concerns. It has been quite an eye-opener presentation from entities now that we are closing up with the department, and I hope that as we prepare for our BRRR, we have quite some issues that are to empower us more, and worse that we are just freshly coming from an oversight, and that has really what I think, Minister, what you are raising, and the AG is coming back on the. Is going to make another presentation on the sector. They did say that they are coming in. I think this issue of one person felt offended, I think maybe I was insensitive, is a chairperson of another province who has never been in the health sector. And I said, you know, one thing that you health is very complex. You must understand it. It's not just like being in a classroom, and I pick up that, oh my God, I think even with the AG, one will have to, we'll start ourselves pushing and really pushing that health. You can never, ever prove how many you say, because really, immunization cards, they go with patients. So what does mean? So yes, there are some other things, but there are things that really in health. So we do think that we have also opened ourselves, our eyes also on some of the issues that we will come back. We'll come back to get some detail. The reason that we want detail, you'll understand that majority of people, even ourselves as politicians, when we're playing political games, we always say health institutions, public health institutions are a place to die. But we are from one public hospital, among others, in Bloemfontein, in Bethlehem. Nothing is outsourced in that hospital. But the Office of the Health Standard Compliance said that we were on them. Nothing is outsourced, but it's one of the. So we are going to make that as a case study, that when you outsource, when you have got strong leadership that is prepared to listen and lead, you are able to turn around the situation. And think that hospital in Bethlehem, in Thabobo Fosanyana, is one of the cases that, I've just forgotten the name. What is the name? And on the other side, you have got the word. If we had powers, Minister, would have closed Manap. Sorry that we didn't have powers to do that. That's what they are saying, that which is to be proved. But put that aside, leadership in that institution.
Chairperson, may I ask you, outside the pilot, can you visit Senorita Nhlabathi Hospital in Lady Brand? Because I want you to compare these things as you say. There's a South African-built private hospital in Maseru. People are leaving that one to cross the border to come to that district hospital in Lady Brand, built by government. Nothing is outsourced. If you look at it, any private hospital you have ever visited will look exactly the same as that. So people are actually living a private built and run hospital in Maseru to cross the border to come to Lady Brand. I want you to visit it.
In fact, we were, it's only that the distance, we had that in mind, that when we will have, but we have to check the distance between itself and the district that we were. I don't know whether it is...
11 kilometers from
Maseru. I think it's the department that told us that, and we said when we'll be so, but we'll try and create space so that we are then able to go to there. But we came back from Thabo Fosanyana in Manapo. I don't want to talk about leadership. I don't want to bore you. It was a disaster from the start until the end. Mm-hmm. But we raised that with the leadership of
the people.
It was
the biggest hospital in Kwatwane, named after their
king.
Yeah.
Which one?
Yes, it's right inside... what was the capital of Kwakwa province?
Yes,
it was one of the biggest. Then you must understand, Chairperson, because it was built in as a homeland hospital, they have to put it away. We will go and look at it because we might have to relocate it.
But we are rolling up on myself. We are rounding up now.
Yeah, I want to ask a question, Chair.
On what?
I asked for a clinic
in Everton. It was supposed to have been built, and I told that they use a container, and the owner of the container got fed up and said they must relocate. He hasn't won there. And I've been promised that something will be done, and years go by and the people start finding or we don't want to help. And you, as you know, all the clinics there are 104 years old, if not older. But this one was never built. They put a container in an open space that is earmarked for building a clinic. It's 7 years now. Please.
Give us details.
Sorry?
Sure. Give us details. We'll try to
help. The department knows. Details and everything.
Okay.
Sure. I think we need to thank the department also that during our visit, the infrastructure officials were there with us.
Thank you for reminding. The, from the start to the end of our
not Joe,
and your office was represented by Joe. He will tell you how we have conducted our oversight. Everybody was shocked. We went to one hospital and found a doctor performing a procedure without these little things. Without an apron, when you ask, but why are you not wearing, and you find them, that is strange. One was expelling air from a drip through the window.
Huh.
That, unfortunately, is one of the best, where there will be those Molanyana things. We are told that the CEO at Tshwane District Hospital have turned things around.
Yeah.
And we could see, I was saying to them, I pity them. Working under that CEO, I'm sure they just don't have even the time. But what was exciting about it is that also the community was starting to say, yes, they are short-staffed, yes, they have got, we'll give you the report at the appropriate time, but we are happy that they are doing their best, and we are told we are from Parliament, please ensure that they employ more people. Ordinary people, of all color and race, you could see that they appreciate the work that is being done by the staff, short and burn out as they are. So I think we will please follow up the issue of Honorable Maisel. I agree he's not raising this for the first time. I think in the next day we will, but I did tell him that he has got all the right to check with the minister, how far are you with this? Shouldn't have waited until we are back in the committee. Having said that, it was quite a tiring marathon of 3 days, but I do think that we are going to develop one of the best reports in the portfolio committee in this time around. Thank you very much. The meeting stand adjourned. So,
I'm going to go to the next one.